Energy and Climate will come to order if folks can find a seat. We do have a quorum. Representative Stevenson, will you move approval of the minutes from January 31st?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that the committee approve the minutes from our last meeting on January 31st.
Thanks. All of those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are approved. We are going to now welcome our Rick O'Connell, Executive
Director. It's not working. Yeah, thank you.
It's not working. We are welcoming Rick O'Connell from, he's the Executive Director of GridLab. Welcome to the committee. He will be speaking for 15 minutes. We will have 15 minutes of questions. Welcome to the committee, and if you would introduce yourself for the record.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, I'm Rick O'Connell. I'm the Executive Director of GridLab. It's a national organization that provides policy and technical expertise around complex grid issues. I'm honored to be here. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. I'm honored to be here and excited to talk about the Smarter Grid Report, which came out around August of 2018. I was asked about 18 months ago to help project manage the study that was funded by the McKnight Foundation. And the McKnight Foundation really both conceived and funded the study. Dr. Chris Clack of Vibrant Clean Energy executed the modeling and produced the report over the course of a year. So this was a long and thoughtful process. There were other folks involved. Synapse Energy Economics helped with the load forecasts and the electrification. And we had a robust stakeholder process, which I managed, which included input from a large number of organizations in Minnesota, including Xcel Energy. So the purpose of the report was really to understand the role of the electricity sector, the potential role of the electricity sector in decarbonizing Minnesota's economy, to meet it really its climate goals as laid out in the Next Generation Energy Act. So we wanted to understand if it was technically and economically feasible to decarbonize the electric sector. So in other words, remove the carbon from the electric sector. And then if through electrification, we could successfully decarbonize other sectors. So we wanted to know what technologies might be chosen, how much it would all cost, what the impact to jobs and GDP would be to the state, and we wanted to also understand what the role of the wider electrical grid would be, and what the role of customer-sided resources, such as rooftop solar and demand response. So we started the study by really looking at our economy-wide and identifying other sectors that might be able to be electrified, such as transport and buildings. And so electrification really means converting current fossil fuel, such as internal combustion engines for cars, or natural gas for space heating or water heating, converting that to electricity. And then that electricity, in turn, would be decarbonized over the next 30 years via the deployment of carbon-free energy resources. And then because we were looking so far in the future, I think it was Yogi Berra who said, predictions are difficult, especially those about the future. We used the DOE's annual technology baseline. This is developed by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. So this is a widely used forecast of the cost of energy technologies in the future. So things like wind, solar, storage, natural gas, nuclear. So we estimated that roughly two-thirds of commercial buildings and three-quarters of residential buildings would convert to space heating and water heating through electrification, so they'd convert to electricity. And we also included significant energy efficiency in all sectors, so industrial, residential, and commercial. We estimated that almost 90%, so 89% of vehicle miles traveled from light-duty vehicles would be electric by 2050, and about 22% of medium and heavy-duty vehicle miles traveled would be electric by 2050. And so because other sectors are going to find it costly and difficult to decarbonize, and the electric sector so far has actually been pretty successful, both here in Minnesota and across the country in decarbonizing, we made a target of 91% decarbonization by 2050. Please don't ask me why that wasn't a round number. In order to decarbonize the economy as a whole. So I do have most of the slides that were handouts are just repeating these points, but there is one graphical depiction, which is slide 5. One of the things that's really important that we did is we assumed very aggressive energy efficiency. And so what we're seeing on this slide is really the difference in load or electric load between our business as usual or our base case and the decarbonization case. And here what you can see is we have a lot of new load from electrifying transport, so that's the bars above the line. And then below the line, we have a lot of reducing in load because of industrial energy efficiency. And even though we're adding load through electrification of space and water heating, efficiency really sort of cancels that out. So really the commercial and residential sectors actually have a small decrease. And then I just want to talk a little bit about Dr. Chris Clack at Vibrant Clean Energy, who actually, as I said, was the modeler and the author of the report. So he was a researcher at NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmosphere Administration. He understood that, you know, power systems and weather systems were actually really linked, that, you know, obviously our load increases when it's very cold or very hot, and now that we're deploying a lot of things like wind and solar and hydro that are weather-related, it's really important to understand weather to understand the electric system. So he built a very detailed model called WISDOM. This model actually doesn't just model Minnesota. He modeled the entire Eastern Interconnection, and he models it at very fine-grained detail, so down to 3 kilometers square and every 5 minutes. So this is very detailed, and you can see there's in the slides there's some pretty pictures of, you know, the detail of like wind and solar data that he uses. So you need that level of sophistication when you're modeling high penetration of renewables. And so his model hasn't just been used for this study. The Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, or MISO, used his model to understand high renewables. And the University of Minnesota also used his model in a study to understand the impact of storage on electric grids. And just recently, Colorado did some modeling to understand how to replace retiring coal with other capacity. And his model doesn't just model sort of bulk electric things like utility-scale solar plants, hydro, gas plants, but also looks at the demand side as well, so looking at customer-sided resources, electric vehicles, demand response. So in this study, we ran 13 different scenarios, and you always run different scenarios to understand the impacts of different things happening, you know, things like higher natural gas prices. One of the key scenarios we ran, of course, was a background or kind of a business as usual case that we could compare all the other scenarios to. And so that was a case where we didn't have carbon targets in the model. And then for each of the main scenarios, we actually also had little sub-scenarios where we either allowed or didn't allow transmission expansion to connect to the wider grid. So we looked at scenarios where we had higher percentage of customer-sided resources. We looked at scenarios where we weren't allowed to get flexibility from customer-sided resources. And we also did some scenarios around the 2 nuclear plants in Minnesota where we allowed them to retire early or kept them on until 2050. In the baseline scenarios, we keep them on through their licensing expiration dates. So what were the outcomes of the modeling? What were sort of our takeaways? I think the headline is really that decarbonizing the electricity sector is cost-effective and feasible. So we're able to do this reliably. In terms of costs, the costs were lower in all of the scenarios. I think the other big takeaway was that electrifying other sectors like transport and buildings actually complements decarbonization. So one of the interesting takeaways was, as you use electricity to heat buildings, then that increases the value of winter energy, and that increases the value of wind energy. So we actually ended up deploying a lot of wind in this scenario. Other key takeaways would be we reduced the criteria air pollutants dramatically. So this isn't just carbon, but also sulfur dioxide, NOx, particulate matter, all the other criteria pollutants. And we increased jobs. So jobs in the energy sector tripled through the study period by the end of 2050. And then I think the other thing that was interesting is that I think a lot of previous studies had looked at very high renewable penetrations required significant transmission expansion or very large transmission expansion. And while we saw the need for transmission expansion, and if we didn't include transmission expansion, the cost went up, that these scenarios only require what we would call modest transmission. So we're still sharing power with neighboring states. I think the other thing that we learned was that having flexibility in things like electric vehicle charging, so having flexible loads on the customer side really also reduce costs of decarbonization. So I think that's another key takeaway in terms of going forward, is that having that flexibility of load is very important for increased variable generation and reducing costs. And then finally, I would say that in the short term, the decarbonization case and the business as usual case, sort of no policy case, look very similar up to just before 2030. After 2030, they diverge pretty radically. So I think that's, sort of in closing, I would say, Minnesota is particularly blessed with strong renewable resources. And I think, through the study, we spent a lot of time thinking about how the electricity sector could decarbonize as well as help other sectors decarbonize. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions or talk further.
Questions from members? Representative Groffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, there are two schools of thought on the pricing of energy. Some people view higher energy costs as a feature, that it makes more energy efficiency programs cost effective. It makes people waste less because the commodity is more. And there's another mindset that says that higher energy costs are actually destructive, that it leads to the outsourcing of pollution to other low-cost jurisdictions, that it has a negative impact on the economy. Which of those schools of thought would you say that you personally agree with?
That's a great question, member. I'm not sure. I wasn't aware of those schools of thought, so I haven't really joined one as of this time. I would say that we're in a unique. We're in a unique period where currently, right now, wind and solar costs are somewhere where we didn't think they would be 10 years ago. They're actually pretty low cost, and so I think we are in a position where there's abundance, right? So there's an abundance of cheap energy, and we just have to figure out the right way to use it. And that's maybe being more flexible with the way we use it, more flexible with our demand, sort of rethinking the way we use the power system to take advantage of this cheap energy. So I don't know if that was responsive to your question, but.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, I'll ask it a different way then. Are higher energy prices a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, I'm not sure that, I'm an engineer, not an economist. So if you're saying if there's like price elasticity of demand, yeah, I'm not sure that this report really addresses that. Like, we don't look at a high energy price scenario versus low energy price. I guess I would say one thing is that one of the things that electrification does is it increases the utilization of the electricity system. So one of the reasons that we saw lower prices was that we're actually using more electricity, and so we're getting more out of the assets that we already have in the ground, like transmission and distribution. So that's one of the reasons why we see lower prices, is because we're actually using the system more. You know, as you know, right now we sort of design our system to for the three highest days of the year. The rest of the time, the electricity system's not at full capacity. So the more that we can sort of fill the electricity system with the better utilization we get out of the assets that we have. I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I would agree with that. And obviously, right now we're seeing in the passenger sedan market, I mean, essentially the gas mobile market is shutting down and converting to electrification. And in that scenario, we kind of have the best of both worlds, where electric vehicles offer us a lower lifetime cost of ownership, and with very few exceptions, the emissions profile is below that of consuming gasoline. So that's a win-win. But one of I respect the fact that you're an engineer, but as policymakers, we have to be able to differentiate those policies that reduce pollution in a cost-effective way and those that have reduced pollution but do it in a very expensive way. That's a factor that we have to consider, and it's one of the things that we try to ask of our testifiers. But thank you for your testimony today.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Sosinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Just kind of, you mentioned that we currently have an abundance of cheap energy. You know, kind of in your professional engineer role, like, do you feel that we have kind of a glut in the energy market right now?
I would say that there's, you know, most of the major organized markets like MISO or PJM have excess capacity. That's because we haven't had low growth over the last 10 years. And I think when I was referring to the glut, I was really saying that there's a large amount of renewable resources available at very low cost. We just need to figure out the most intelligent way to use them.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have a question on transmission of energy across the states and the difficulty of where we stand with turning toward more use of the wind and renewables, and faced with cold weeks like we had last week. What would the upgrades be needed here in Minnesota to maintain the system?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, member, for the question. With variable resources like wind and solar, it's important to have a larger geographic footprint because, you know, it may not be windy or sunny in Minnesota, but it might be windy or sunny somewhere else where you can get, so you can exchange. You have, you know, what we call diversity, right? So diversity is a good thing, and I think, like I said earlier, I think earlier studies would assume that for us to get the diversity we need to build significant transmission. So, for instance, the National Renewable Energy Lab recently did a study called the SEAM study, where they looked at doing this sort of large macro grid or strengthening the ties between the eastern and the western grids to sort of exchange wind energy from the Midwest to other parts or solar energy from the Southwest. I think in this study, one of the things that came out was that we didn't, while we needed, you know, transmission definitely helped and additional transmission definitely helped, it was sort of on the order of the transmission build that we've been going through the last 10 years, like with the MISO MTEP projects. And it wasn't some massive new, you know, build that would be, I think, quite difficult. And I think part of that was due to the fact that as the load shape changes and we start using more energy in winter, we can actually start using more wind power from Minnesota and not have to import power. So I don't know, that's a long way of answering your question, but I think that, you know, I think the transmission upgrades that we saw here were lower than we expected, or lower than we've seen in previous studies. And I think part of that was because of the way the load changed. Is that helpful?
Are there other questions for members? Seeing no other questions right now, thank you so much for coming. Thank you for your testimony. We will be leaning on you later and on your report. Representative Long.
Should. I mean, you bought them. Right? Well, Madam Chair, before the author begins, I see we have some fine treats here for the committee. I think we can dispense with the public testimony and just move on to voting and moving this bill on to this committee.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. I appreciate it.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my first bill to be heard as a legislator and also my first bill before the committee, so I brought some treats from District 61B, our very own Woollett Bakery, so feel free to partake and enjoy. I also wanted to mention that Senator Nick Frenz, our Senate author of this bill, was here earlier, had to leave, but wanted to thank him for his presence and coming by. And wanted to thank the large group that we have gathered here today. This is clearly an issue that Minnesotans care deeply about and are passionate about. I understand there are overflow several dozen people in the hallway as well. So thank you to everybody who took your time to be here today. Over the past 3 weeks in this committee, Madam Chair and members, we have heard powerful testimony about the impact that climate change is having in Minnesota. Mark Seeley told us the pace of change in our climate is completely unprecedented and that Minnesota is changing the fastest in the nation. Professor Freelich told us that by 2070, Minnesota could look like Kansas and that the boreal forest could be gone from our state. Dr. Sura Panini noted that asthma, allergies, tick-borne diseases are all getting worse. Professor Gutnick told us that if winters are warmer, more pests will live, which will harm our crop yields. Minnesota is seeing real impacts from climate change now, and we know we must act urgently to confront this crisis. But our national leaders are failing to address climate change. We are the only country in the world to reject the landmark Paris Climate Agreement. It used to be us and Syria, and then Syria got its act together. So now it's just us and the world. And that makes it even more critical for states like Minnesota to lead. And we know we can be a leader because we've done it in the past. We enacted the 2007 Next Generation Energy Act under the signature of a Republican governor and 97% of the legislature. And we set a target of 25% renewable energy by 2025. And in 2007, that sounded really bold and potentially not even achievable. It was ambitious. But thanks to advances in clean energy technology, Minnesota met that goal last year, 7 years ahead of schedule. That's a good news story. Clean energy jobs in Minnesota are growing twice as fast as the economy as a whole. Minnesota is home to the number one solar construction company and two of the top wind building companies in the country. This is all really good news. The bad news is that we're not moving fast enough, and we're still failing to meet our greenhouse gas targets. We heard from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on our progress on the targets that were set out in our Next Generation Energy Act. Our first goal was 15% reduction below 2005 levels by 2015, and we only reduced 12%. Our furthest goal is an 80% reduction by 2050, and we're not on track to meet these goals either. We also are slipping behind some of the other states near us, some of our neighbors, and states around the country in terms of pushing forward on a clean energy and creating clean energy jobs. Iowa, our neighbor to the south, is beating us in wind production, even though Minnesota has more wind potential. Last year, Minnesota didn't even make the top 20 states for solar jobs. So we need to reestablish our position as a national leader on clean energy. But as we have heard from our previous presenter, and as we know from other studies, 100% clean energy is achievable. Three other states have already committed to 100% clean power. The Wisconsin and Colorado governors have both committed to 100% clean power. Our state's largest utility, Xcel Energy, became the first major utility in the country to commit itself to 100% clean energy, which is really notable. Cities in Minnesota are also leading the way. Rochester, St. Louis Park, and Minneapolis have all committed to transition to 100% clean energy by the early 2030s. Major companies as well, like Wells Fargo, General Motors, and Apple have joined more than 150 major companies in pledging to move to 100% renewable energy. So all of these stakeholders know that 100% is achievable. 100% is also the cheapest long-term option for Minnesota. Wind is currently the cheapest form of electricity, period. Dr. Mohan shared with this committee that the Lazard levelized cost of energy estimates, which is pretty wonky, but just means essentially the price. And that's, Lazard is an investment firm, so not a group that is going to be fudging the numbers. And they show that wind and solar are both cheaper than even natural gas. In fact, building new wind is cheaper than simply running a coal or natural gas plant that is already built. And it has the added benefit of a guaranteed cost, so no susceptibility to price swings. Right now, natural gas price is low, but it may not always be. And if we have a built-in cost for wind and solar, that has advantages to ratepayers. Solar, too, is cheaper than any new fossil fuel plants. So then the question is, well, why do we need a renewable energy standard? We've got clean energy that is cheaper than ever. And that's because business as usual and relying on markets is not going to get the job done in time. The crisis is urgent. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said that we have 12 years to start taking meaningful action to reduce climate pollution. They've also said that every bit of warming matters, and limiting warming by even a half degree would have huge benefits. Business as usual also fails to consider the impacts of climate pollution on our health and the environment, so-called externalities, which aren't taken into account in normal markets. They don't calculate, for example, the estimated 2,000 early deaths in the Twin Cities annually from air pollution. They don't calculate that these health impacts are felt most by the poor and by people of color. They don't calculate the $40 million spent just last year on 10 natural disasters and 49 impacted counties across Minnesota. And to put that in perspective, that would pay for 650 additional teachers in our schools. If we're looking at business as usual and relying on markets, we're also not considering the broader economic benefits to Minnesota, which is something that the legislature should certainly take into account. Minnesota doesn't have fossil fuels. We don't produce natural gas, we don't produce petroleum, we don't produce coal. And we're sending $13 billion a year out of state to buy energy. If we invested that money in Minnesota to create Minnesota energy with our wind and solar resources, we can create a great number of jobs here in Minnesota, 50,000 jobs estimated by Mr. O'Connell's study, and grow some of the businesses that we know are succeeding here and helping our state become more competitive. So the bill that we're having our informational hearing on today sets out an achievable path towards 100% clean energy. The utilities in the state that are not Xcel will be required to reach 55% renewable energy by 2030, 80% renewable energy by 2035, and 100% carbon-free energy by 2050. Xcel's goals are 5% more aggressive for the renewable target and 5 years earlier for the carbon-free target. The carbon-free standard is new, and it is incorporated as the last step because the best research that I've seen shows us that we know how to get to 80% to 90% renewable energy affordably with current technology. The last 10 to 20%, we are still going to need new technological innovation, which is why the bill is technology neutral on reaching 100%. But we also have a generation and a half to get there, and if the last renewable energy standard is any indication, we very well could get there cheaper and faster than we know with our current knowledge about what technology is right now. The bill maintains the flexibility that's in the current renewable energy standard for the Public Utilities Commission if meeting our targets significantly affects energy costs or reliability for Minnesotans. And it also ensures that the Public Utilities Commission is implementing the standard in a way that benefits communities across the state. This includes considering the impact on transition communities that currently host fossil fuel generation, as well as ensuring that the transition creates good Minnesota jobs. I believe Minnesota has a once-in-a-generation opportunity to lead our nation's transition to clean energy. It's time to set the next energy vision for Minnesota and give the electric industry the certainty they need to plan for a least cost, reliable future that benefits all Minnesotans. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to take questions.
Representative Crotchell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. Thank you, Representative Long, and again, thank you for the treats. First question, are we going to have a fiscal note on this bill?
I have not requested one at this point.
And Madam Chair, the author, are you going to be requesting one?
Madam Chair, Representative Graflow, I'd defer to conversations with the Chair on whether one is needed, but if one is requested, I'd be happy to.
We will request one if we see a fiscal impact on the state or local governments.
Well, Madam Chair, we would find out if there was an impact on state government through the fiscal note. So if we don't have a fiscal note, how do we know that it doesn't cost anything?
And you expect that there's going to be a fiscal impact on state government?
Well, the way we do, Madam Chair, the way we do this is that we ask the experts to put together a fiscal note, and then they answer the question for us. I don't get to decide. You don't get to decide. So will there be a fiscal note requested?
We'll see.
Okay. Second question for the author of the bill is, you know, different bills are introduced at different times for different reasons. And I just want to give you a chance. Is this a bill that you actually envision getting signed into law this year, or is this more aspirational about what we hope, what you would hope would happen from a policy outcome?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I always introduce bills hoping that they get passed. My Senate author, Senator Frentz, is working hard to get it passed in the Senate. We'll see where we get at the end of the day. I know that any bill that is introduced is going to have changes before it is adopted. One of the reasons I asked that this be an informational hearing today is to make sure that we weren't locked into taking a final vote on this so that we could gather information and hear feedback on the bill's contents as it's currently drafted.
And Madam Chair, to the testifier, one of the drawbacks of the composition of this committee is that there are no members of the majority party from rural Minnesota. Can you explain to me how this bill separates how investor-owned utilities are treated versus cooperative utilities, besides the lower percentage amount that is for non-Excel areas? Because obviously co-ops and IOUs are substantially different utilities, and how they can respond to this sort of dramatic policy change. Aside from the different percentage, how are you providing accommodations for member-owned utilities?
Madam Chair, Representative Graflow, the bill maintains the same distinction for Excel and for all other utilities in the state that is currently under the renewable energy standard. I'll note that Great River Energy, which supplies a large amount of power to a number of our cooperatives in the state, has bold renewable energy goals. They've set a 50% renewable energy goal by 2030. I know we have a lot of folks coming to testify from the municipals and co-ops this afternoon and this morning, and I'm looking forward to hearing their testimony and feedback on the bill.
Madam Chair, and to Representative Long, you know, most recently we had a huge stressor to our energy system last week where Minnesotans were consuming huge amounts of energy. You combine that with the fact that 20% of the year the sun sets in Minnesota before 5 p.m. and that most wind turbines do not safely operate. In fact, they shut them down at about 10 degrees below Fahrenheit. Given that situation, as you envision this bill, if we had that weather event, how would we conceivably keep the lights on?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, thank you for the question. It's an important one. I think in the reliability space, I often hear arguments that are made that tend to favor the energy source that is favored by the individual in general. I'm not suggesting you are. I'm just saying this as a broad statement. So I think reliability has a different meaning in different contexts. If you look at the 2014 polar vortex in the Northeast, there wound up being large impacts on coal and natural gas resources. There were coal piles that froze. There were tubes for boilers that froze as well. And so in that case, wind actually wound up taking up a lot of the slack that natural gas and coal when those resources were coming offline. There are some impacts, as you noted, in terms of wind and very cold weather, and so I think that's something that we need to take a close look at. Part of it is, as a previous testifier mentioned, making sure that you have a broad area that is feeding into our system and not just Minnesota, but resources from around the region. One of the testifiers before our committee, Mark Alstrom from NextEra Resources, mentioned that there are also some real benefits to reliability when you make a transition. So, for example, some of the new resources that are coming online in terms of demand management or looking at storage can provide enhanced reliability to the grid from our current system. And so engineers who are smarter than I believe that you could do a transition to full renewable energy and actually have a grid that is more reliable and more resilient than the grid that we have right now.
Madam Chair, my final question then for the author. My understanding is that the three most important goals of this legislation are to reduce pollution, lower costs, and to try to insource energy creation in the state of Minnesota. So instead of exporting dollars, we're bringing them into the state of Minnesota. I assume that if I'm wrong about those three things, you'll correct me with your answer. But would utilities be able to meet this standard by purchasing RECs from other states?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, that's a good question. I'm not sure if under the current version they're able to purchase RECs. I might defer to our researcher, Bobby Leff, on that question.
Well, while our incredibly talented nonpartisan staff is looking this up, if I could just, I'll ask the author then the follow-up to that, and that is that in the event that a utility decides to purchase RECs, how does that accomplish the goal of either reducing pollution, lowering costs, or insourcing job create energy production into the state of Minnesota? Because no reasonable assessment of the purchasing of RECs could say that any one of those three things are true.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think it might be less true for the third, but the first two it would be true for. If you are purchasing RECs, you are getting credit for real renewable energy reductions, which is having an overall benefit for the environment. And for cost, I think we've talked a little bit about the cheaper costs in general of wind and solar resources. Your point is well taken on jobs. If we're going to be purchasing RECs from out of state, then that wouldn't be meeting the intent of my third goal, which is to produce as large a number of Minnesota jobs and clean energy as we can. And so that's, I think, a fair question.
And Madam Chair and Representative Long, but when you purchase a REC, you're not purchasing the power, you're just purchasing the rights to the power. So this power already exists, so you're not reducing pollution. When it comes to reducing costs, you're not reducing costs because, again, you are simply buying a piece of paper that says somewhere someone's producing renewable energy. And then we agree on the third point. So when it comes to the purchasing of RECs, it doesn't reduce pollution, it doesn't lower costs. In fact, it increases costs because all it is an adder on an existing power source, and it's definitely not in there. So given that fact, how would purchasing RECs be consistent with the goals of this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, you're only allowed to sell a REC to one person, so you're getting credit for the renewable energy that is being produced with that one sale. So that energy resource is being used to reduce pollution, and there is the REC is the way to track that. So I think I would disagree that the RECs aren't a way to reduce pollution. I take your broader point about out-of-state RECs, and I think that's something I'd be interested in looking into.
And Madam Chair and Representative Long, but when you purchase a REC, you are not using the power. When someone puts a utility-scale solar project up in southern Nevada, Nevada Energy consumes the power. They have extra RECs. They simply sell us a certificate saying, yeah, this is renewable energy we're consuming down here. Up in Minnesota, you're still using coal, you're still using natural gas or hydro, so there is no environmental benefit. But if you can tell me why I'm wrong, I'm happy to hear an answer to it.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, my understanding is that if, to take your hypothetical for a Nevada utility, if they're selling the REC, the utility themselves can't use that REC to meet their own requirements. And so it's only being used once to meet one target, so it would be applied to the Minnesota target. You're right, you wouldn't get the clean air benefits of reducing pollution in Minnesota, but you would get the climate benefits of reducing carbon emissions overall.
If we can have Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In answer to Representative Garofalo's question, I'm looking at subdivision four of the statute, which isn't in your bill because it's not being changed by this bill. But what it says is, in lieu of generating or procuring energy directly to satisfy the eligible energy technology objective or standard of this section, an electric utility may utilize renewable energy credits allowed under the program to satisfy the objective or standard. Madam Chair, I also agree with Representative Garofalo when he said you can't heat a house on RECs. I believe this was put into the law to enable those utilities that weren't generating or procuring energy from eligible energy technologies to, in effect, meet this statute by paying extra to buy RECs. They still had to supply the energy, which cost them. They also had to buy RECs, which cost them. And I believe the thinking was that extra cost would enable them to invest in more eligible energy technologies so they wouldn't have to pay for RECs from outside.
With that, we're going to go to the next questioner, and I am noting the clock, members. We're going to finish the questions now in a few minutes, and we will have another opportunity this afternoon because we're reconvening at 4. So those of you who are on the list, will stay on the list and will be the first up when we come back at 4:30. Representative Nichols.
I didn't ask for a question.
Oh, it's Representative Mahoney. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions about the bill, not so much the energy or how you're getting it, but you're asking the PUC to take into consideration the creation of high-quality jobs in Minnesota paying wages that support families. Any definition to that? Because I have a member on my committee that thinks $20,000 is the jobs committee is a good high-quality job. I really believe that you start a high-quality job somewhere above $50,000. So do you have any, and maybe that's something you need to think about or put more thought to how you do that. But if you have an answer now, that's fine.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's a great observation. I think that it is not defined currently in the bill, and perhaps that's something we can look at working together on and seeing if we can add some clarity on.
And then, because I'm unlikely to come back for this evening's session, we're trying to be family friendly around here. You're eliminating the waste to energy classification as renewable energy. Does that have any tax implications for that particular energy? For that particular energy.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I am not aware of tax implications that this would have. The reason that waste energy was removed is that simply that resource is not carbon free. And when the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency came and presented to us, they noted that there is carbon pollution and emissions that come from waste energy resources. So if our goal is to be working towards meeting our 80% reductions that we've set into law by 2050, then that resource is not going to be as helpful as renewable energy and other carbon free resources. This would not prohibit waste energy resources from operating. It simply would not allow them to get credit as renewable energy, and so they wouldn't be able to sell renewable energy credits, for example.
Madam Chair, there are a variety of waste energy facilities. I've had two of them in my office saying that it would essentially kill that particular industry, and that's fine if that's what your intent is, but I work at down in Dakota County and drive by Pine Bend landfill, and on occasion for my hobby I have to drive all the way up to Princeton and drive up 169, and I don't know the name of that particular landfill. And in today's world, if you reasonably well read, China's not taking any more of our recycling unless it's absolutely pure and they've set some standards. I don't know all the standards. That's going to create more of a problem for our landfills. And already the one down by Pine Bend is about 8 stories high, maybe 9, and I'm told it goes the same down below. that's part of the consideration of what we're doing here. How do I want to say this? What we do in one committee affects, or in one hand, affects the other hand. And that's going to be problematic because that's a water issue. No matter how good of a lining you put into those things, they leak sooner or later. So somehow or another, your bill has to start looking at that particular piece of it also. Because more likely than not, they'll just shut those down and take that tonnage out to Pine Bend or the other one up north. So that's a consideration we need to look at when we're doing this, because it's changing one pollution for another. And that's a fear for me, because we need to address them both. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, thanks for the question. Alternatives aren't only burning or disposing in a landfill. We don't have particularly high diversion rates in the state of Minnesota compared to a number of other states and localities on the front end, in particular in the organic space, which if you were diverting organics, you have significant carbon benefits for one, but are also able to produce usable materials in terms of, you know, additives for farming or for gardening, et cetera. You're correct that the recycling market right now is in a tough space with China's decision, but, you know, recycling markets, I think, have fluctuated over the years and hopefully will come back. And I think your point's well taken. We should think about how we are managing our waste stream. And I know Representative Fornstein and others have pushed very hard for having increased diversion and increased resources coming in on the front end for recycling and composting. And that's personally what I would favor in terms of moving forward as a state on our waste management policies.
About 15 years ago, I chaired a bioscience committee, and some of the best engineers in the land told me that they would have joint replacement material so you didn't have to do surgery. Because I'm looking at that as a construction worker, I've worn out a couple of joints here or there. And they said, 5 to 10 years max, 10 years max. 15 years later, not the same ones, but very similar with similar reputation, say, 15 to 20 years away. So our engineers, we love them. We say great things about them, but they're very optimistic.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Long. We're going to now go to the testifiers that have signed up. And members, there we will have member questions later on this afternoon. Members, 40-some people have signed up to testify. We are limiting testimony to 2 minutes apiece. And if the first three best testifiers would come up, Anna Grace Hottender, Lila Harrell, and Mandy Fernandes. If you would come up together, you can each take your turn, introduce yourself for the record. And after they are here, we will hear from Mike Noble and then Beth Soholt. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record. We're glad you're here.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Anna Grace Hottinger, and I'm 15, and I'm from Shoreview, Minnesota. I'm here representing Minnesota Can't Wait, a coalition of determined youth developed this fall from various organizations, including iMatter, Yamen, which is the Youth Environmental Activists of Minnesota, and we are all youth anticipating to make a difference throughout our gorgeous state and be better leaders in the nation, taking bold and urgent action on climate change. We are here today in support of Rep. Long's bill because it's a bridge towards demolishing our dependency on dirty energy and steering away from the climate crisis. This bill encompasses various parts of what we as a movement are working for through shifting the economy and society towards renewables. The imminent climate crisis is terrifying. My sister, Mary Claire, who lives in California, was trapped in the California wildfires this fall. The buildings surrounding her had burnt down, forcing her to leave for her own safety. What happened to her jolted me into the reality of how little time we have to take action on climate change. People are already losing their lives, especially those that are already impoverished, not just to wildfires, but to hurricanes, heat waves, cold waves, drought, and more. It terrifies me to see how much worse I can get and how next time my sister or someone else I love might not survive. But if we act now, we have a chance. I'm dedicating this time because I think we are capable of creating a better future. Fighting for our futures can bring people together rather than separating them. We can all come together on this issue, and I'm hopeful to it, because this is an everybody issue. No matter one's race, class, sexuality, politics, and so much more, we can fight this together. By supporting Rep Long's bill, you'll be advocating for the rights of youth, ecosystems, and adults to the fair and just rights of life, liberty, and overall happiness. All of those are at risk due to climate change. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Leah Harrell, and I am a senior at Hopkins High School in the West Metro. I am part of Minnesota Can't Wait, a youth-led statewide movement pushing for a rapid and equitable transition to a sustainable economy. We support this bill as achieving 100% renewable energy is a crucial goal of our movement. I came to be a part of the climate discussion rather by accident. I signed up to be a part of my school's Earth Club on a whim during my sophomore year of high school, expecting to be loosely involved with saving the polar bears and picking up trash around campus. When I started hearing the words climate change floating among my peers, I questioned what that term meant for Minnesota. The sea level has not risen to my doorstep. The forest fires have not engulfed my neighborhood canopy, and the hurricanes have not beaten down the walls of my home. Yet, my Earth Club helped me recognize the localized impacts of climate change. In the mere 18 years that I have lived in the great state of Minnesota, I've witnessed it becoming more common for thermometers to climb to extreme highs and plummet to extreme lows, threatening my health. I've witnessed the staple crops of our state become vulnerable, threatening my food security. I've witnessed increasingly strong precipitation events damage my public and private infrastructure, threatening my community's economic growth. This is the reality, and the reality is threatening my future. My Earth Club also helped me recognize another aspect related to climate change, the growing movement of youth fighting against it and who are not letting their age define what they think they can achieve. Like Anna Grace and Maddie and hundreds of others, I've stepped into this leadership role out of the necessity to protect the life ahead of me and the lives around me. We will not tolerate inaction because we can't wait. We must work together to achieve progress because it is not a Democratic future or a Republican future. It is just our future. I stand here today because this bill plays an invaluable role in determining how your generation is going to leave the state of Minnesota for my generation. Though there is still much more to be done, I support a transition to 100% renewable energy as one component of the broader solution. So I'll say it again, and I won't stop saying it. Minnesota can't wait. Let's protect our future by taking action today. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you my story.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Maddie Fernandes. I'm 15 years old, and I'm from Edina, Minnesota. I'm here today to share about the Minnesota Can't Wait youth campaign, as well as the importance of the work that we're currently doing. As Anna Grace said, Minnesota Can't Wait came together this fall as a coalition of youth-led environmental organizations that wished to make a difference not only on a local level, but on a state level. After seeing the potential societal change that we can make by working on all levels of government, we joined together as Minnesotan youth to work towards one common goal, avoiding the climate crisis. We are in support of Representative Long's bill because we believe it to be in the step in the right direction in avoiding climate catastrophe. This bill supports our vision of completely shifting the economy towards a green and sustainable future and off of fossil fuels. In addition, it also adheres to the 12-year deadline that Representative Long himself expressed by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that expressed that we have 12 years until the point of no return for climate. Personally, I find that when people are confronted with the drastic timelines expressed in reports such as the UN's IPCC, there is a tendency to be fearful and therefore unacting on climate change. I personally felt this way before I jumped into climate advocacy. However, I saw the young leaders such as Greta Thunberg and Varshini Prakash taking action and making a difference in the national and international scale, which inspired me to position myself here in Minnesota. So I wish to potentially inspire others about taking actions themselves. The truth is that although the situation is dire, we as students in a society can still take action to slow and reverse the progression of climate change, because I truly want Minnesotan winters to remain snowy, and I don't want Minnesotans to die and experience extreme temperatures and weather swings that cause people to freeze to death. I want Minnesotans to feel food secure. I don't want there to be food deserts in Minnesota that cause people to starve to death. I want Minnesotans to feel healthy. I don't want there to be a health crisis around the migration of mosquitoes carrying disease. I want Minnesotans to have their 10,000 lakes. I don't want them to dry up. I implore you, committee, to deeply enshrine and protect us youth's right to life, liberty, and happiness, all of which would be destroyed by climate change. In supporting Representative Long's bill, you'd be demonstrating precisely this, and you'd be protecting our right to a future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mike Noble and if Beth Sohol will be ready. And after her, Dr. Mike Menzel. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Noble. I'm the Executive Director at Fresh Energy. I'm speaking today on behalf of Fresh Energy. Our colleague, J. Drake Hamilton, was supposed to be here today, but she had a quite serious injury yesterday on a fall in the ice. Minnesota is ready for this conversation of 100% clean energy solution. This is our chance. This is our historic chance. And I agree with the young people that Minnesota really can't wait. We've heard from Rick O'Connell from Grid Lab that very, very deep reductions in carbon emissions and electrifying more and more of our economy are going to be economic, reliable, good for the economy, and good for the environment, saving money. The reason this bill is ready for debate, this reason this bill is ready for discussion, reason this bill is ready for passage, is that the 100% solution is now is our time. Today's bill is made possible by our state's largest electric company, Xcel Energy, that deserves enormous congratulations for announcing that it will be 80% carbon-free within about 10 or 11 years across its 8-state footprint, and it will be carbon-free across 80% carbon-free by 2030 and 100% carbon-free in all 8 states by 2050. Today's bill has been made possible by dozens of Minnesota corporations calling for 100% clean energy, dozens of corporations all over the world. Cities, states, 10 governors have now pledged to have 100% clean energy. This bill is made possible by the technology. Every single expert forecast that's ever been made by our Federal Energy Information Agency has been far surpassed by reality on the ground, with the prices falling and renewable energy being deployed more fastly than experts ever predicted. This bill is made possible by our children, our young people, who are telling us about the science in clear and unequivocal language that Minnesota can't wait. I think it is quite remarkable now that the science is more clearly and generally understood than it ever has been in 30 years. Most people can tell you now that within about 12 years, we have to have deep, deep, deep cuts in carbon pollution, or it's game over. We'll have missed the window. We'll miss the opportunity. You know, you heard so much from your land-grant university, your University of Minnesota, that all of our industries, our agriculture, our tourism, our forestry are all at risk from a changing climate, and our natural resources that make Minnesota a place that we all embrace and love are at deep risk from a changing climate. Now is the time. This bill can't wait. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Beth Soholt. And Dr. Mike Menzel will be right after her. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What a daunting task to follow Michael Noble and those great kids. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Beth Soholt. I'm the Executive Director of Clean Grid Alliance. Some of you might know us formerly as Wind on the Wires. We are a St. Paul-based nonprofit organization working to advance renewable energy. We work in Minnesota and 8 other Midwest states on technical and engineering issues and public policy for clean electricity. Clean Grid Alliance has a long history of working with many stakeholders, including utilities, to implement state renewable energy goals and requirements. Clean Grid Alliance is a unique collaboration of NGOs, many of my colleagues are in the room this morning, and businesses that can help utilities deliver projects and deliver renewable energy, including wind, solar, and increasingly storage projects. As such, we have seen firsthand the benefits that renewable energy development has brought to the state of Minnesota. For instance, 1/4 of the counties in Minnesota receive wind tax revenue that can be used to offset tax increases for residents, make capital improvements, or support schools or emergency services. The local counties get to decide themselves what to do with the tax revenue. So the more than $7 billion in Minnesota wind farms means over $12 million annually in tax revenue for Minnesota counties. These benefits are the result of thoughtful public policy passed by the Minnesota legislature and supported by several governors over the last 18 years. Utilities have worked closely with their regulators in the case of investor-owned utilities and with their boards of directors and members in the case of cooperatives and municipals to find good and cost-effective projects to meet the policies the legislature passed. Utilities have done an outstanding job of meeting renewable energy policy, notably years ahead of time. I applaud the chair, Representative Long, and committee members for your leadership on these important issues. Many Minnesotans are asking their utilities for additional renewable energy, and surrounding states such as Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin are having conversations about taking the next steps of carbon reduction, electrifying the economy, and market rules and infrastructure needed to keep the electric grid reliable. So you are in good company. And just one final quick comment. Passing significant energy policy takes lots of discussion to find pathways that work for Minnesota utilities and other stakeholders. We have a significant challenge but great opportunity in the next 15 years and beyond. Thank you for your leadership in this conversation.
Dr. Mike Menzel. And after him, Isaac Orr.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Mike Menzel, and speak to you today as a physician who's practiced medicine in Minnesota for over 34 years. I'm a co-founder of Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate, which is a Minnesota organization with over 450 health professionals. Our organization educates and advocates for the health of our patients who are being impacted by climate change. Several recent peer-reviewed medical studies are crystal clear that it's telling us that the cost to our health and well-being by postponing action will be substantial. Minnesota's climate is changing. Dangerous weather extremes are more frequent. Fossil fuel pollution is contaminating our air and water, and our patients are getting sick. My 9-year-old grandson with a history of asthma, it's worse whenever their air quality index is over 100. And it's heart-wrenching to watch a child struggle to breathe. Lyme's disease, which can be severely debilitating, is now reported in all counties of Minnesota, whereas when I was a medical student, it was only a handful of counties. Minnesota patients with pre-existing heart disease and lung disease, COPD, coronary artery disease, are at a higher risk of dying prematurely. And now we understand more about the fossil fuel-related developmental disorders. Just last month in the Journal of the American Medical Association, There was a study that showed that our increasing number of heat stress days is resulting in a higher incidence of fetal congenital heart disease, and it's in pregnant women. And this is the Midwest states are being impacted the most. The emotional and financial costs of these health impacts, plus the loss of home, your workplace, or a loved one from a natural disaster, has resulted in a growing population experiencing severe mental distress. And these impacts are borne by all, but certainly the children and the elderly and those at the lower economic scale are experiencing the most severe. There's little doubt among health professionals and major medical organizations that climate change is a medical emergency. But the prescription's not complicated. To have good health, you must live in a healthy environment. An EPA study from 2014 estimated that a return of $30 for every dollar invested in reducing air pollution. You can make an important historic difference by supporting the legislation to get us to 100% renewable. We need to look at the cost benefits, certainly, but then we also have to ask, what are the costs of moving too slowly? It's a complex issue, as this book on climate change and health, the size of it might indicate, but I know we can do it. And I'm grateful to members of both parties here for the hard work that goes into understanding these issues and acting on them. Thank you.
Thank you. Isaac Orr, and then Jessica Trichich.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Isaac Orr, and I am a policy fellow at Center of the American Experiment. My colleagues and I are in the final stages of putting the finishing touches on it, doubling down on failure, how a 50% renewable energy standard will cost Minnesota $80 billion and have negligible environmental benefits. And I'm here to show you, or just share some of the executive summary findings. So this system will cost $80 billion to implement by 2030 and maintain through 2050. Which is an average household cost of $1,200 per year for every Minnesota household. It will increase electricity prices by 4.3 cents per kilowatt hour on average, increasing this 41.5% relative to November 2018 prices. It will cause monthly electricity bills to rise by $32 a month and $386 per year. The Edina School District would have to lay off 10 teachers to make up for the cost of higher electricity prices. This would harm energy-intensive industries such as agriculture, healthcare, manufacturing, and mining the most, and it would decrease CO2 emissions in the most expensive way possible. It would cost $135.22 to do this with wind and solar. We found that nuclear energy would be able to do this for $112. So my takeaway for right now is let's legalize nuclear power because we can decarbonize much faster, and we should also allow large hydro. Other than that, reducing Minnesota's all of the CO2 emitted from our electric generating industry would eliminate 0.028 gigatons of CO2 in the atmosphere. Last year, the global production was 37.1. So we really have to weigh costs and benefits when we are looking at the best way to proceed. So I would say let's legalize new nuclear power plants. They offer a much more affordable. They would save $22 billion at least. Also, the community solar garden, wow, really expensive, $135 per megawatt hour. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to sharing these findings at a later date.
Thank you. Jessie Trichich, and after her, Greg Mast.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Jessica Trich. I am the senior campaign representative with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. The Sierra Club is the nation's oldest and largest grassroots environmental organization. In Minnesota, we represent 80,000 members and supporters empowered to protect communities by addressing the state's most urgent environmental issues. I am very excited to be here today to speak on in support of House File 700. Thank you, committee, for your leadership, as the many experts who you have brought around in the last few weeks have testified. We need bold action on climate, and we need it now. Minnesota has been a leader in setting strong goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but as you know, we're not on track to meet those goals. So now is the time for us to move forward with 100% clean and equitable energy that it benefits all Minnesotans, starting with the way that we generate electricity here in the state. We've made strong progress moving away from coal and investing in wind, solar, and energy savings. All of our electric utilities are on track to meet or exceed our current renewable energy standard because the cost of wind and solar continue to decline. Xcel Energy is already committed to 100% carbon-free energy by 2050. It's time to set the benchmarks higher. Sierra Club believes that we can meet or exceed the renewable benchmarks in this bill and supports meeting 100% carbon-free energy with 100% renewable energy. We also see a huge opportunity in this transition from fossil fuels towards renewable energy, an unprecedented opportunity to reshape our energy system and ensure that clean energy benefits all Minnesotans. This bill speaks to some of these opportunities, removing garbage burning as a renewable resource to help protect the health of our communities, the creation of new local family-sustaining clean energy jobs in our state, ensuring a just transition for workers and communities that are hosting retiring power plants, reducing air pollution in communities that have been historically burdened by pollution, and more. This bill is a critical first step on our path to 100% clean and equitable energy in Minnesota. On behalf of the Sierra Club and on behalf of myself and my two little boys, who I hope to be able to share Minnesota winters and the boreal forests up north with as they get a little older, and maybe this summer too, we all urge you to support this bill and support 100% clean energy for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg Mast, and after him, Kevin Lee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Mast, and I'm the Executive Director of Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. We are an industry-led nonprofit organization dedicated to growing and strengthening Minnesota's clean energy business ecosystem. Our membership is comprised of clean energy companies ranging from startup businesses to Fortune 100 and 500 corporations who employ thousands of Minnesotans across the state. Today, I'm here to testify in support of House File 700, a bill that would strengthen our state's clean energy businesses through policy leadership. Our organization's tagline is unleashing the power of innovation to propel Minnesota forward. This bill helps drive innovation and supports development of abundant and homegrown renewable energy. For our member companies, policy leadership provides an increased level of certainty to clean energy businesses. Strong policies also tell business owners and investors that Minnesota is deeply committed to retaining, growing, and attracting clean energy jobs and investment here in Minnesota. So at the end of the day, policy certainty plays a critical role in driving market expansion and success. While advances in technology and business model innovations are driving down the costs for renewable energy, strong policies, like the ones that we are all gathered here today to discuss, are still needed to ensure timely investments are made in low-cost and competitive clean energy resources by our utility partners. Today, Minnesota is home to over 59,000 clean energy jobs, and these jobs are growing two times faster than all other sectors of our state's economy, according to the 2018 Clean Jobs Midwest report. Over the past year alone, renewable energy generation jobs, like those associated with wind, solar, and bioenergy, grew 16.5%, which was the highest growth rate across the entire 12-state Midwest region. And this growth is bringing benefits to all corners of our state, as 40% of clean energy jobs reside throughout greater Minnesota. The renewable energy standard has played a critical role in growing these jobs, and now is the time to take action to ensure that renewables will continue to enhance our near and long-term economic competitiveness. Taking action and increasing our collective ambition will also set us on a path to proactively mitigate the serious risks posed by carbon emissions throughout our electricity sector. Without swift action, we risk ceding our leadership position to others while simultaneously hindering the fastest growing sector of our state's economy. So in closing, House File 700 provides a clear and predictable pathway that will usher in further growth for Minnesota's clean energy sector. And that means additional opportunities for our member businesses, from Duluth to Mankato, from Red Lake Falls to Rochester, from St. Cloud to Winona. Our members experience firsthand the benefits that innovative clean energy solutions provide, reducing costs, mitigating risks, and spurring new market opportunities as demand from consumers continues to rise. Accelerating our transition to a cleaner and cheaper energy system will provide Minnesota with a competitive advantage and spur additional economic opportunities and benefits for all Minnesotans. This bill will also continue to diversify our state's energy mix by significantly expanding our use of clean, reliable, and affordable energy. Our organization looks forward to working with all of you and other stakeholders in the near term to move Minnesota towards a thriving and prosperous clean energy future. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Lee, and afterwards Julie Nearborn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Kevin Lee, and I am the Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I'm very excited to be here at this hearing for a number of reasons. I'm excited to express our support for this bill, and I also appreciate the opportunity to express our gratitude to the leadership of this committee for taking it up. But I think even more importantly, I'm excited because this hearing is one of the first of its kind in this state. For the first time, we have a bill that truly reflects the scale of the crisis that we face. And it gives me tremendous hope that we have leaders in this body that have the fortitude to do what it takes to protect future generations. We're in desperate need of that hope, because the truth is that despite the ambition of this bill, we cannot mistake it for a climate solution. The climate solution that we need and that we can create together will involve a suite of policies that complement this bill. These policies will target specific sectors outside the electricity sector targeted by this bill, like transportation, industry, and agriculture. They will involve incentives and rebates to electrify HVAC systems, water heating and cooking in nearly every home and business in the state. They will involve programs to modernize or retrofit every fossil fuel-fired process line in heavy industry. It will also mean electrifying virtually the entire transportation sector, cars, trucks, buses, trains, and freight trucks. But this bill lies at the center of these policies, because decarbonizing the generation of electricity is the engine that drives greenhouse gas reductions in those sectors. I'm confident that we can do this. I'm confident because we have no choice. We are the last generation that has the opportunity and the ability to create the future, to use our governor's words. I don't do this work for myself, and I know that you don't either. I do this for my son, Alex, and my daughter, Eleanor. In the year 2080, they will be in their 60s. And if we do nothing, the world will be a very different place. From the ambition of this bill, I know that you will be there for this fight going forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Julia Nearborn, and after her, Sheila Lamb. Welcome.
Hello, and thank you for having me here this morning. My name is Julia Nearborn, and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. We work with over 400 congregations and thousands of faith actors across Minnesota who believe that it's our moral calling to ensure that we have a livable planet for all humans and non-human relatives. Throughout Minnesota, faith communities have been taking the lead on climate justice, reducing carbon in their houses of worship through installing solar, doing lighting retrofits and energy efficiency projects, and showing up here at the Capitol to make sure that decision makers hear their voice and move us towards 100% renewables. Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light strongly supports this legislation for reasons that are widely shared. One, it is grounded in a theology of the possible. Look to our north, and Ontario Power is currently 99% carbon free. Look to our south, and Mid-American Energy will be 100% net carbon free when it completes its next wind farm in 2020. Yes, this legislation makes sense. Just this past June, Shiloh Temple Community Solar Garden went live, and it now provides power to a mosque and a church in North Minneapolis and 26 local residents. Two, this legislation grows out of a theology of abundance. The sun showers to the earth immense energy every day. And in the upper Midwest, if there were 20 million corn to ethanol acres transitioned to solar, the energy would power 400 million homes. And as the kids at Shiloh Temple, Just Be Solar Camp shared, hey, why not? It's fun, and it's free energy. Three, This legislation supports a theology of justice and caring. Tens of thousands of new jobs will be created that will enrich lives like Levi's, who participated in the Department of Corrections solar training program this last year while he was incarcerated at Willow River Correctional Facility. Now he is out of prison and he has a living wage job working in the solar industry. So this is something we can do together with Levi, with the kids at Shiloh Temple, and across Minnesota. We can create a 100% better future. Thanks.
Thank you. Sheila Lamb, and after her, Mark Bonhorst.
Madam Chair, representatives, thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Sheila Lamb. I'm a volunteer with MIN 350, which is part of the national organization 350.org. But today, I'm not going to throw all the science at you that you've been hearing, because we need to look at another aspect of this as well. As a mother and as a grandmother, I've spent years worrying about broken bones, children falling off bikes, and skinned knees. My children range in age from 14 into their mid-30s. Our conversations sadly have changed to the point of anxiety and depression in our youth because they don't know what the future has to hold for them. We're dealing with a socioeconomic impact in dealing with these things in our children, and we are negligent and remiss when we're not hearing the voices of our youth who are standing up and saying, we no longer have an assurance of a healthy and safe future. Our children are stating, we're worried about our air, we're worried about our water, and they're even to the point of doubting whether or not they will bring children of their own into this world, and we need to pay attention to our youth. In 2007, Minnesota proved that we can set efficient goals for clean energy, and we met those expectations earlier than planned. Now, Minnesota, instead of being the leader, has started to lag behind states such as New York and California that have already put these 100% goals in process. It can and needs to be done. We need to stand up for our children and our grandchildren and future generations, support this bill and anything that has to do with clean and renewable energy to ensure the future of those that come after us. Thank you for your time.
Mark Bornhurst, and after him, Kenrick Schiefel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm a member of First Universalist Church Environmental Justice Team. We were part of a Unitarian Universalist Solar Garden program, which harnessed five churches, over 100 members who signed up to a community solar garden. Excuse me. I'm also a part of the Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light Policy Team. So I just sort of, in addition to what Julia just talked about, I'd like to say that this bill also celebrates a theology of creativity. It revels in the amazing dynamism of the moment in which we live. 2 years ago, I wrote a letter to Governor Dayton asking why we were going to build a super-sized gas plant. I was really taken by the Republican luminaries who were talking about carbon fee and dividend as a free market way to address climate change. If we're going to be raising the cost of natural gas, why are we talking about building this super-sized gas plant, I wondered. Part of that letter was an attachment or a link to an article in Forbes about the amazing new storage technology that might happen involving vanadium flow batteries, batteries that have essentially infinite lives. Last month, The Economist, talking about how China is going to take over the scientific world, they devote two paragraphs to vanadium flow batteries that China is starting to install right now. You know, not engineers who are being optimistic, but businesses that are implementing this technology right now. It's 60 times more powerful than the battery in Australia. So I think there's just tremendous opportunities. Becker and Sherco could be places where you could implement research and actually put on the ground flow batteries. That could become a location, a go-to location for green companies like Google. And the other amazing opportunities, consider a farm economy where you have all these additional crops, wind, solar, storage, EV charging, and you get paid for sequestering carbon with good farming techniques. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Kenrick Schievel, and after that, we will have a representative from Otter Tail Power.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Committee members, my name is Kenrick Schievel. I am a government relations representative for Dairyland Power Cooperative. Members, as you're aware, Minnesota serving utilities are rapidly incorporating wind, solar, and renewable enabling natural gas generation into our portfolios. However, even as our industry embraces the adoption of renewable energy resources, I am concerned about proposals that appear to ignore the engineering limits of existing technology. Let me illustrate with two examples. Last summer, the weekend of August 10th, you remember it was hot, about 93 degrees, high humidity, air conditioning load spiked. Of the 17,000 megawatts of wind generation potential in the entire MISO footprint, we averaged about 200 megawatts that entire weekend, 200 out of 17,000. To put it bluntly, that means there was virtually no wind in the entire Midwest for several days in a row. Uninterrupted electricity was available only because of fossil fuel plants that could be called upon and dispatched at will. Closer to hand, last week, we all experienced firsthand the life-threatening weather extremes of a polar vortex. Electricity demand spiked 4,000 megawatts even as the temperatures plummeted. Unfortunately, wind generation output plummeted with the temperature. From about 13,000 megawatts of generation on Tuesday to approximately 4,500 megawatts of generation on Wednesday and Thursday, creating a gap of about 8,500 megawatts of load versus generation. Once again, uninterrupted electricity was available only because of fossil fuel power plants that could be called upon and dispatched at will. It's important to emphasize that even as our industry incorporates ever greater amounts of renewable energy resources, we still need a balanced all-of-the-above generation portfolio approach if we're to maintain the affordability, the reliability, and sustainability of our national electric grid. Let me conclude my remarks by suggesting that before we take this idea for a drive onto the lake, let's make sure the ice is strong enough.
We have a representative from Otter Tail Power, and I'm sorry I don't have your name on this. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Draxton, representing Otter Tail Power Company. Otter Tail Power Company is a very small utility, in fact, the second smallest investor-owned utility in the country. One of the unique things about us is that we have half of our customers, only half of our customers are in Minnesota, and the rest of our customers reside in the Dakotas. And you're probably quite aware of a significant difference in regulatory and legislative philosophies between Minnesota and the Dakotas. I think one of the things that is very important is that a company like Otter Tail, we have three operating coal facilities, the only one located in Minnesota we've committed to retiring 2 years from now. The other two plants are located in the Dakotas and are owned by multiple partners, none of which are regulated in the state of Minnesota. When Otter Tail makes a decision on a generation resource, much like the prior commenter, we're concerned about three things: reliability, environmental impact, and the cost to our customers. Reliability, as he brought up, was very important just last week, and I was going to give an example very much like he did, so I'll skip that. But I think one of the things that's important is when it was in the mid-minus 30s last week, all of our wind turbines in North Dakota were shut down because of the extreme cold, and in fact had about a 2-megawatt load of the heat they needed to keep the oil warm and to not damage other equipment. So at those times, it can actually become a load rather than a resource. MISO recently released its renewable integration impact assessment, phase two, and in there it showed that once renewables crept over between 30 and 40%, we saw a significant increase required in transmission infrastructure. And we're all aware that that's very expensive and very time consuming to construct. So lastly, back to that three-legged stool of reliability, cost, and environmental impact, my hope is that when Minnesota is considering legislation such as is before you here, that they'll move cautiously and be mindful of the interdependence of reliability, environmental impact, and cost. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Members, we are going to go into recess in just a moment. When we come back at 4:30 in this room, we will start with Representative Long's bill and pick up with questions from members. So that's where we'll start, and then we will finish the testimony from folks. We're about halfway through. So thanks so much. We are in recess. We're reconvening the Committee on Energy and Climate, and we left off with some questions for Representative Long, and we'll start with Representative Baker's. Well, Representative Baker. Representative Swazinski, can we take your question?
Sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a general question on kind of process with this bill. We're kind of doing an informational hearing on it. Are we going to bring this bill back and have an opportunity for amendments? And then, you know, you mentioned earlier in committee that you may or may not request a fiscal note on that, on impacts on state, local governments, and just kind of how that process is going to play out. And kind of just, that's my first question. I have others, so.
Okay. Well, we will be bringing the bill back for amendments. I don't know what date we're going to do that. We have a couple of things scheduled already, so we have some things already queued up, so it won't be within a week.
All right, sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Long, Madam Chair, just talked. It's been mentioned a couple times, that things will be cheaper. I've seen a few publications talking about that each individual family might save between $1,200 to $1,600 if this bill is able to move forward. Are you open to putting that in writing as a guarantee? We've seen. Just from anecdotal evidence in the last 10 years, this process has moved forward, almost a doubling or tripling in rates across the country, and particularly in the Midwest. And just kind of wanted to see, a lot of claims are being made from just a finance standpoint, and just kind of wanted to see what your openness to amendments and support to kind of lock that in, that essentially would say that if things are to move forward to the next rate or whatever next level, that we would be able to just lock that in and guarantee that there is savings there across the board for businesses, industries, families. I just wanted to see what your openness to that is.
Thanks, Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski. So the estimate I think you're citing on energy savings was from the report that Mr. O'Connell presented. $600 to $1,200 a year was what they estimated in savings, assuming a 91% renewable energy at 2050. So that's their estimate. The I think estimates that the utilities are putting out from They are complying with the current renewable energy standard. Some are have reported saving money under the current standard. Some have reported that it's cost a little bit. Depends on the utility. But none of them are reporting significant price impact. And this is looking retrospectively. So prices have come down considerably since in terms of wind power in particular and solar as well. One thing I'll note is that when people mean different things when they talk about price, often they're, I assume you're talking about the rates that customers are paying. So if you're looking at customer rates, that doesn't include some other things they may be paying elsewhere. So healthcare bills, taxes for being able to, you know, take care of transportation infrastructure that was damaged by a storm or things like that. So there is a, I think, a broader cost picture too when you're talking about the overall impact of climate that may not necessarily be taken into rates. Estimates are that renewables are going to save money, that they will continue to be cheaper over time. But to answer your question specifically, the bill doesn't change the language that is currently in the renewable energy standard where the PUC is specifically authorized to take into account the impact on ratepayers, and there is an ability for utilities and others to petition the PUC to modify the application of the renewable energy standard if there is a significant impact on rates.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, are you aware of any times in the history of the POC where they've maybe modified the renewable energy standard because of raising energy rates to customers?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, that has not been requested of the PUC to my knowledge. I will note that our rates in Minnesota are very competitive. We're the third cheapest in the Midwest in terms of price for actual customers. And over the implementation of the renewable energy standard, that we've actually gotten more competitive than a lot of our Midwestern states in terms of the cost to customers. So I think we've seen that renewable energy can work well for customers, and I think that's why you've seen folks like Xcel Energy make a commitment to going to 100%, and folks like Great River Energy make commitments to going to 50%.
Madam Chair, we've talked a little bit about kind of that advancement as we move through the future, and how Xcel is doing what they're doing, and other folks are doing that. It was brought up, I think, last week about a member saying they could cut in half what a local utility was potentially going to be paying from an outside vendor for their electricity. And, you know, I simply brought up, I don't think you necessarily need a mandate to do that. You maybe need a better sales staff. And, you know, are you open up to maybe making this a goal rather than a mandate? Or do you feel that that's the only way that this goal could be moved forward?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I think that the business as usual case that was modeled by the McKnight Foundation report, which is essentially no action, they found that we do make reductions in terms of climate impact in the short term, but by 2030, natural gas has essentially replaced most of the coal plants and a lot of the other generation. And natural gas, while more carbon friendly than coal, it's about 50% less, still has a big carbon impact, and so there would not be significant carbon reductions after 2030 on a business-as-usual model. And so that's, I believe, one of the reasons why we do need a standard to help continue to push forward on renewable energy and to make sure we're doing it in the time frame that the scientists are telling us is necessary.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, from a natural gas perspective, obviously that's going to take up a larger portion. Are you aware of how much more frac sand mining in North Dakota are going to have to be done in order to meet that natural gas need?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I'm not sure. I don't have any information personally about the needs for frac sand mining. I do know that the renewable energy, if you look at the Lazard estimates that I mentioned this morning, wind and solar are cheaper than natural gas right now. And one other thing I'd mention on the natural gas side is that if you're looking at carbon impacts, we're often only looking at the burning side when we're talking about coal versus natural gas, but there's some real open questions on research in terms of fugitive emissions from the pipeline process and as well as from the drilling process. And since natural gas is methane, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, and so even a small percentage of fugitive emissions could have a very large impact on the climate side. And estimates that I've seen are that 2 to 3% fugitive emissions, and you basically wipe out any gains that natural gas has over coal in terms of climate impact. So that's a real concern I have with the move to natural gas as well.
And then just a final question to you, Representative. So if this bill passes, what will be the impact from an international basis on temperature? How much less will it be?
So that's Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, that's a great question. I think that's something that we could model and would be worth asking to model. I think part of it is that's a collective action problem challenge with any large challenge is if one person acts and nobody else does, what's the impact of one person acting? But I think in this instance, we as a state, by showing leadership, can inspire other states to show leadership. We can help push clean energy technology forward in a way that can help other states develop these technologies as well. And I think we've seen other countries model some of the work that the United States has done, and so often have been able to jump over some of the stages of energy development that we've had in this country of having coal or natural gas and going straight to solar or wind economy when you're able to get that those levels of affordability up. So I guess I'm an optimist in saying that we have to do something. I feel like this is important to do. It also has other benefits besides having impact on the climate in terms of health, in terms of jobs. But just speaking about climate specifically, I think that being a leader matters. I think that Minnesota's been a leader in clean energy in the past, and if we're a leader now, then I believe that we can inspire other states to act, and that can have an impact around the globe.
Representative McKellen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Long, excuse me, you talk about 100% fossil fuel free. Between 2023 and 2026, Sherco will be closing down two of its coal plants, and then they're supposed to be putting on a gas-fired plant, natural gas. Will this negate the natural gas fire electric plant?
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, the natural gas plant would not count as carbon-free under the final step, which is the 2050 for most utilities or 2045 for Xcel.
Madam Chair, thank you. So do you have an idea, so if it's, would it still be built currently under what you are proposing here?
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, I think that's a good question for Xcel. They have proposed a carbon-free standard for 2052, which is not too far from the timeline that this bill is proposing. This bill is 2045, so it's 5 years earlier for Xcel. But you know, the utility has a relatively similar time frame in terms of trying to achieve carbon-free with its own energy mix.
Madam Chair. Representative Long, so do you have in this bill anything to compensate the local business, local jobs, between the tax revenue that will be lost as well as all these very strong-paying union jobs?
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, there is in the local benefits section new language, which is a specific instruction to the commission to implement the statute in a way that creates high-quality Minnesota jobs and that also takes into account the impact on local communities that are transitioning away from fossil fuel energy. I'd be happy to work with you if you would be interested in trying to make this language more fleshed out or come up with ways to help communities in transition. I think that that's a real concern that I share and would be very open to figuring out different ways to approach that going forward. I think when you're changing from one technology to another, we need to take into account the impact that's having on real people and their jobs, and so that's something I'm not unsympathetic to.
One more. Another issue that we have in rural Minnesota is, I actually worked on a property not that long ago, year before last, we're required to have dual fuel. So if
If you have propane, for example, you have to have an electric source of heat, or if you're electric, you have to have some form of gas heat or something. And I don't see in here how would that look in this plan going forward that we would have two forms of heat in the event one was lost.
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, are you talking about on the home heating side or on the electric generation side?
Both, really, because if electric is one of your sources, but if the long-term goal is to be fossil-free, I mean, that's what I'm understanding. So, and there was even testimony today, I believe, about eliminating gas stoves, gas water heaters, and such. So if we only have one source going forward because the rest of them don't fit into the carbon-free, how do we address having more?
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, I'm not familiar with a dual fuel requirement on utilities. If there is one, I'd like to know more about it. If you're talking about requirements for individuals, this bill doesn't touch the home heating side in terms of natural gas use or propane use. You did mention that the report that we heard earlier today talks about the transition over time that would make clean energy even more feasible in terms of having a higher adoption of home electric use. And so I think that would, as that's happening, that seems like a good conversation to have about how that would impact individuals and how that might play out. This bill doesn't have any requirements in that space in particular, but I'd certainly be open to talking more about how an increase in beneficial electrification would interact with dual fuel standards.
Thank you.
Members, are there other questions for Representative Long? I see no other questions, Representative. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you. Representative Bo.
That's all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to give others a chance before this side of the table jumped in with more questions, but since someone else did, I have a couple of them. Thank you. Representative Long, as an environmental professional, I do believe that renewable energy will have to be a part of our toolbox, so I applaud the efforts here. But as a former board member for a municipal utility, I have some concerns about mandates, and what I have found over the years in that position was that mandates tend to cause costs to rise, because when a mandate's out there, the suppliers of the services or the materials or the equipment know that there's a mandate there, and they know that they can charge more, so they frequently do. So then the utilities end up having to pay a much higher cost to meet that mandate, and that means that by default, the ratepayers all end up paying more as well. So rather than a mandate, I would rather see market pressures. I think that's a better driver for behaviors. And as I look at our utilities, they're well ahead of their goals now. So I would like to see those mandates or the market pressures really drive that, and therefore the residents don't have to pay that increased cost that a mandate can bring. And so rather than a question, that's a thought, and I'm curious your thoughts as to that, and then I do have one follow-up item as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Bowe, I appreciate your comment. My main interest is in achieving the greenhouse gas goals that we've set as a state. I think that if we left that up to the market as it is now, we're not going to come close. We, our projections that we heard from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency are that we're not on track to reach our goals, and we've failed to miss our goals to date, even though we achieved our renewable energy standard goals to date. So we've also know that the utility sector is likely going to have to overperform some of the other sectors in order to meet our goals because of the difficulty of making reductions in the agriculture sector, the industrial sector. So I think that there is a role for incentives. There is a role for policies that help encourage. There have been proposals out there for using market forces, like putting fees on the price of carbon as one alternative. To my mind, having a renewable energy standard is something that Minnesota knows how to do. It's something we understand. And I think that if you have a long time horizon, like 2050, we're planning towards it, a generation and a half away, that we can deal with some of the predictability issues, and people will know we are going to have to move towards renewable energy over time. And I think one of the differences, too, between now and when we had our previous renewable energy standard is that costs have come way down for wind and solar in particular. And so I think that the impact will be significantly less in terms of the price that you're seeing. And we did see that rate impacts were not large for our utilities from the current renewable energy standard. In some cases, were negative.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, you mentioned something which is another concern, and that is the utilities have had success. And unfortunately, the tendency is to go back to where we've had success. And so in a way, the utilities are actually being penalized because they've had success. So we're going to go back to that same well and ask more from those utility companies because they have done well, whereas other sectors have not done so well. And there's a danger of going back to the same well over and over again as you run the well dry after a while. So that's a concern. Second thought is, you know, regarding, I think it's section 1.5 is what we would refer to it as. I know as a solid waste professional, I've seen the state for quite some time having efforts to promote increased processing of solid waste. And as a result, many counties have invested a large sum of money and a large amount of time and effort into that area. And now we're looking at really pulling the rug out from under solid waste energy, burning solid waste and processing solid waste for energy production. And that concerns me just because a lot of counties have spent a lot of money and now we're, in effect, you know, pulling the rug out from under them right in the middle of that whole process. That's a concern as well, I think. And I think it undermines trust in the system because if you've taken that challenge seriously and gone forward on good faith, and then now this suddenly we change horses in the middle of the stream, that makes it tough to get folks at the county level to come on board again at some point in the future. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Bowe, to your first question, I think that when you're looking at the reductions that have to be made across the economy, I think it makes sense for us as a committee to focus on those that are most cost effective and most achievable, and those happen to be in the utility sector at the moment. Transportation is one that there's a lot of cost-effective gains to be had too, as well as industrial efficiency. But agriculture is very hard to come by solutions that are as cost-effective as working in the public utility sector. So in some ways that is it may be viewed as unfair, it may be viewed as an opportunity, I think, for the utility sector there right now. As I mentioned in my remarks this morning, most of our investment in the electric sector is going out of state, mostly going to buy fossil fuels from other states. And so if we're able to actually bring back that investment to Minnesota, then we can create significantly more jobs. 50,000 was the projection from Ignite in terms of solar and wind jobs alone. So I think that is a real opportunity that the utilities and us as a state can look at. On the waste energy question, you know, this bill doesn't prohibit that form of energy production. It's something that the, you know, utility that can be used by counties and others for waste management purposes or for producing steam or other purposes. But the purpose of this act is to really focus on the greenhouse gas and carbon impact. And unfortunately, waste energy does have a carbon impact. And so it didn't, I don't think, make sense to keep waste energy in a bill that was seeking to have a zero carbon goal.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Swazinski, did you have another question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to Representative Long. Does nuclear power count as carbon-free energy?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, yes, it does.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, does large-scale hydro count as carbon-free energy?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, this bill doesn't specify. It would be up to the Public Utilities Commission to determine, but from my perspective, there's nothing in this bill that would prohibit that being viewed as a carbon-free resource.
Madam Chair, Representative, would you support a change in law so that that would be considered part of carbon-free energy?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm very open to conversations about hydro. I think that hydro is an important part of clean energy, and so that's something I'd be open to having more conversations about.
Is that a yes?
I'm not going to, negotiate the bill, I think, at this point. I'd be open to having conversations with utilities and others about different paths to get to 100%. But I think that hydro's been used as a clean power for a long time. And there are concerns, I think, that were intended to get at with the original bill about new hydro and especially new large hydro and the impacts that can have on ecosystems. But I think there is some nuance to be had in the hydro discussion.
Madam Chair, just coming up with a few more here. So let's just say, because, obviously the technology doesn't exist for this to be a possibility right now as a bill. Let's say that coal, we come up with a new technology that captures 100% of the carbon out of a coal-fired plant. Would you support that?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, so if you're talking about carbon capture technology, I think that would be up to the Public Utilities Commission to determine if that meets the definition of not emitting carbon dioxide. If the Public Utilities Commission determined that, then it would be a part of the regular process before the Public Utilities Commission to assess whether that's a good deal for ratepayers. My guess is that it won't be. My guess is that renewable energy is going to be much cheaper for the foreseeable future than carbon capture. There's been efforts around the country to develop carbon capture, and to date they've been prohibitively expensive.
And just kind of just one more, Madam Chair, Representative, are you aware how many acres to create a certain amount of solar? I mean, I know Xcel's done about 22,000 acres or is on the process of doing that in solar. And just what this would potentially mean for more land potentially being taken out of production. Do you have a rough estimate on what that would potentially mean to land use and across the state?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have an acreage estimate on hand. I do know that there are a lot of farmers who are very eager to participate in solar energy and see it as a good way to diversify, have different sources of income compared to the other crops that they're producing.
And I'll just end with I think as we take more and more acres out of production here in the U.S., we talked a lot about, are we just exporting our dirty to someplace else? Every acre we take out of the U.S. is probably an acre of rainforest being cut down in Brazil. So,
are there other questions, members? I don't see any. Thank you, Representative Long. We are going to now begin with public testimony, and we have first Jawari Jama. And after that, Eric Passy. Thank you for coming. Would you say your name for the record?
Jawaria Jama.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, my name is Jawaria Jama, and I'm a 15-year-old freshman at Spring Lake Park High School. I represent Congressional District 5 on the Minnesota Youth Council, and I'm speaking today as a member of MN Can't Wait. MN Can't Wait is a youth-led climate change organization that are fighting for effective climate change solutions before it's too late. The first time I went camping was last summer when I was 14. I went to Camp Bovee in Wisconsin for 2 weeks. That was one of the best experiences of my life. At camp, we learned life skills like how to identify plants, canoe across a lake, set our own fire, and make our own food. We even had our own Camp Olympics and got to compete in things we learned there. Thinking back now about that experience, my little sister is the first person that comes to mind. She's going to turn 2 in April, and in a decade when she's my age, I'm not sure if she'll be able to have the same experiences that I've had. Climate change affects things like our hobbies and interests, but it's much more than that. Though I want my sister to experience things like camping, we have to make sure that our planet is safe enough for her to live a long, healthy life, one where her only worries are finishing her homework and not a climate crisis. Right now, my family lives in Heritage Park in North Minneapolis. Our neighborhood is predominantly African American and a place that has seen the effects of climate change. From my window, I can see the air pollution coming out of multiple factories going into our streets. For a while, I've never thought about the outcome,
but studies conducted by the Minnesota Pollution Agency and the Minnesota Department of Health has shown that 1,000 plus people die every single year in the Twin Cities due to air pollution. These agencies have also stated that poor minority communities are more at risk for developing asthma and other health-related issues due to air pollution. If we don't fight back right now for 100% renewable energy in the next decade, I'm scared for my sister's childhood and the lives of many around us. Because I'm from a minority community, I understand what it's like to be left out of the conversation. I'm speaking up right now so that the next generation has a place to call home. We need 100% renewable energy, and we need it now, because MN cannot wait. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Eric Passy, and after that, Cliff Kaler. And from just a reminder to folks that testimony should be no more than 2 minutes, and we do have a signal up here for how you're doing. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Eric Passy. I'm the Chief Development Officer for IPS Solar. We're a local solar company based out of Roseville, Minnesota, and a Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association member. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing this important testimony today. Since 2015, our company IPS has grown over 600%. And in 2013, we had 3 full-time employees. This year, we will support over 500 workers and contribute over $100 million in economic development in the state. We don't need to choose between the planet and the economy. We don't need to choose between low-cost energy and clean air and water. Since I started in solar 12 years ago to today, solar panels are 95% less expensive, and those cost declines are accelerating. Our projects are providing nearly $25 million in local taxes and wages in the state. And we're paying local farmers over $25 million with rates sometimes double or triple what they'd get for agriculture. Added to that, we're planting pollinator-friendly seed mix at all of our sites. We don't need to choose between the planet and the economy. Solar installer is the fastest growing job in Minnesota and the country. And solar beat out natural gas in head-to-head pricing in Minnesota in 2015. We do not need to choose between the planet and the economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Cliff Kaler, and next on the list would be Kathleen Doran Norton.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Will Georgia with Novel Energy Solutions. I'm filling in for Cliff Kaler tonight. And Novel Energy is a local Minnesota developer as well, founded in 2012 in St. Charles, Minnesota. So we were founded by fifth-generation farmers who've been in agriculture in Minnesota for over 130 years. Today we're in St. Charles as well as St. Paul, and we've seen just a tremendous amount of growth in jobs and energy savings for our customers. So we started in agriculture. Most of our customers are rural farmers who want to save money because their utility costs keep rising. A lot of our customers are small businesses who also want to save money because their utility costs keep rising. So we're in the business of offering our customers energy savings and making their bottom line work. And you know, in 2012, we started with 3 employees. Today, we're at 40 employees, and over the next year, we see ourselves at least doubling in the amount of people we're looking to hire. And if we had a bill like this one, we could see even doubling that amount over the next few years, because those kind of policies create certainty around the technology and the need. And so for us, that's additional jobs just in our business. That doesn't include what's in the supply chain, what we have in construction hires, and ultimately what gets saved by the local communities, the people who are using this electricity. So I want to urge you to support this bill, and thank you for the time.
Thank you. Kathleen Doran Norton, and after her, Thor Underdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Doran Norton from Bridgewater Township in Rice County. I've been a township supervisor for a dozen years, a member of ISEA and St. Dominic's Catholic Church. I'm here to speak in support of the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting Minnesota scientists to talk about the impacts of climate change on Minnesota. As I listened in my living room, I remember joking with the township board about how 100 years wasn't what it used to be. But it also brought to mind standing in a road ditch, looking at our truck with 6 inches of gravel underneath it and 6 feet of nothing underneath that. Or a twisted culvert that should have had 15 more years of life. Climate change means water, wind, and weeds. In the last couple of years, we've been dealing with invasive wild parsnip on our roadside and having to spend money on equipment and labor for that. For small communities, climate change is financial death by 1,000 costs. Pope Francis, in his encyclical Laudato Si, urges us to hear both the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor. And a couple of years ago, we had a parish forum on energy and poverty, and I learned that low-income folks pay 2 to 3 times what the more fortunate among us pay. This bill seems to have a One Minnesota approach, assuring that no tribal member or Section 8 renter or poor rural family is left behind. I'm excited to see this bill. I hope it passes the House and the Senate and Governor Walz signs it, that the benchmarks are passed earlier than required, and we do the 1,000 other things that we need to do to have 100% carbon emission free Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Thor Underdahl, and then next, Vicki O'Day.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Thor Underdahl. I'm with Minnesota Power. We are officed out of Duluth, Minnesota. We're an investor-owned utility, and we serve about a 26,000-square-mile service area from Duluth down to Little Falls, Long Prairie, all the way up to International Falls. Want to thank the author, first of all, for starting this important conversation. He's been very forthcoming and sitting down and having these discussions, and that's much appreciated, and this is a good starting point for that. You know, as a utility that's been here for over 100 years, we really value the relationships we have with policymakers in helping to move Minnesota forward on these energy initiatives, and we want to make sure we get the details right. We're a very unique utility in that about 60% of our revenues come from 12 large industrial customers. So that's very unique to just Minnesota Power. Usually it's the flip of that, and it's mostly residential. So these are large taconite mines. These are paper mills. They're really the lifeblood of northeastern Minnesota. They're incredibly energy intensive, and so they feel the brunt of any price increases quickly, and they trade commodities that really don't have a premium price to be kind of absorbed like some other businesses do. So we're very sensitive to that, and we want to make sure that we consider those important entities in these discussions. You know, we were just a little over 10 years ago a coal-based utility that had 95% coal, and we've made significant strides to be over 30% renewables at this point, shooting towards 44%, with a caveat that I'll mention in a section in just a second in 2025, and with a carbon reduction of 40% by 2025, so well above our stated goals as a state. But what we're getting to right now is what our engineers like to refer to as the load-bearing walls of the electric system. And these are these really big, large generation pieces of the infrastructure that we're talking about taking off. Big transitions for the communities, really big transmissions for the systems, and we want to make sure we're having a robust and thoughtful conversation about that. In our next resource plan, we'll be digging into this and doing a baseload study and looking at these things very specific to us. What are the cost implications, and what are the constraints in different areas, and how can we most cost effectively do it? So we want to make sure we allow for that time as well, too. And then I would say thank you to Representative Swedzinski for bringing an important point to light. When we're talking about carbon reduction as the goal, we don't think we should take any tools off the table. For us, that's large hydro. We have a 250-megawatt power purchase agreement that will start in 2020. It's a 12% of our overall portfolio, so ostensibly, if this bill were to pass, we would have to go 12% farther than every other utility similarly situated to us, so we feel that's a bit of an unfair advantage. And then finally, just on the feasibility studies, we think these are important to consider, but each have their pros and cons. Everyone can set their assumptions how they would like to. So we want to consider a robust set of feasibility assessments, including those by MISO, the independent system operator, who's looking at the renewable integration impact study and what that would mean for our system. Thanks for bringing this forward, Representative Long, and we look forward to the future discussion.
Thank you. Vicki O'Day and next Barb Draper.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Vicki O'Day. I am in 57A, Robert, Representative Bierman's district, and I work for the Rural Renewable Energy Alliance, which is located in Backus, Minnesota, which is in north central Minnesota, rural Minnesota, and I'm the development director there. And REAL has been around since 2000, and our work is to make solar energy accessible to low-income people. And so we've been fighting energy poverty since 2000 with solar thermal and solar electric technologies. And so the bill, the local benefits in the bill, thank you, Representative Long, are really important to us, as well as the, you know, the increments with the utilities to help us do our work and solve the problem of energy poverty in this country, which 43 million Americans are affected by. So that's my professional self. As a person, I'm a grandmother. I have a 7-year-old granddaughter. Her name is Amaya, and she is in the Woodbury. She goes to Spanish immersion school, and she's a very smart young woman. She stayed overnight at my house over the weekend, and we have been watching since my grandmother Edna died 2 years ago. We have been watching YouTube videos and going to museums to figure out what this thing about death is about, what makes civilizations rise and fall. This is a very critical conversation that we're having today for my granddaughter, Amaya. And so I'm here representing her voice and the voices of grandmothers. I just want to say to you that I'm very grateful for this time, and I want to read a poem that we wrote after my grandmother died about generations and ancestors. Ancestors are the non-living. Generations are the living. Before a baby is born, she is an ancestor and a future generation. Ancestors set the stage. Generations care for the stage. Generations honor the life that was and create the life that will be. Ancestors are the non-living and generations are the living. The we that we are hearing this now means we are the generation for now. Ancestors set the stage. Generations care for the stage. Tell me then, how are we caring for the stage? Thank you for your leadership.
Thank you. Barb Draper and then Reverend Sarah Campbell. Barb Draper is not here. Reverend Sarah Campbell. Committee members, I especially welcome Reverend Campbell since she is my pastor.
Thank you all for your work and this long day. You're still here. I am Sarah Campbell, senior minister at Mayflower Church in Minneapolis. I am a Minnesotan through and through, baptized in Moorhead, part of every summer of my life spent in the North Woods, college in St. Paul. I choose this state, what my colleagues call flyover land, because I love the four bold seasons. I'm a spouse, parent of two adult daughters, and now a grandmother. I have many loves. I love my people. I love my church. I love the children of my church. I love my religion, the stories, the spiritual practices, the Jesus path. But humanity is destroying God's creation. It's happening faster than we thought it would. I pray for the earth. I also pray for the souls of my people, whom I love, especially for the children of my church. What is going on in the souls of our children when they hear what is really happening on the earth? This is a planetary crisis. It is also a crisis of meaning, of religion. It's pulling the rug out from underneath absolutely everything. And here is the damnedest and the most hopeful thing about this, the biggest crisis humanity has ever faced. We have everything we need to fix it. Everything. It's like having a spreading cancer and knowing that the treatment is available. 10 years ago, some of us were in the upper room at Mayflower despairing about the earth, and then someone said, what's our plan? So how are we as a church going to become carbon neutral? We made our building more efficient, installed 200 solar panels. We're still working our plan, and in the striving, we are joyful and hopeful. I need to skip ahead. I'm going to go to this spot. My most sacred place on this earth is on the high banks of Leech Lake. And I've been going there since I was a baby. In August, I held my granddaughter, 3 months old, and we listened to the loons calling out. And when she's 20 and I'm almost 80, I hope to listen to the loons with her still. And maybe after she'll say to me, Nonna, did you know that we almost lost all this? I was learning in my history class about how it all turned in 1 year. It all turned. It was called the Green New Deal. They did this thing in Minnesota and in other states too. 100% clean energy, and it transformed the whole state economy, bringing opportunities for people who didn't have them before. Did you know this, Nonna? And I'll smile and I will say, oh, sweetie, I met the most wonderful people in that movement. All different kinds of people, and we were strong and smart and hopeful. Here we are, February 5th, 2019, Minnesota. It all begins today. And someday you can all tell your grandchild that you were there when it all began. Thank you.
Nick Baker. And after that, Kelsey Johnson.
Madam Chairperson, representatives, my name is Nick Baker. I'm representing the Sierra Club. I would like to tell you about a conversation I had with a 19-year-old University of Minnesota student. We were discussing climate change, and at one point she looked at me wistfully and said, you know, in a way, your people your age are really lucky. You'll probably be dead before it gets really bad. This is a step towards proving her wrong. Please.
Kelsey Johnson and then Kevin Corrado.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of this committee. My name is Kelsey Johnson. I'm president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. Our association represents 6 operating iron mines and 2 idled pig iron facilities in northeastern Minnesota. The iron mines directly employ 4,500 people, and the vendor member community that supports these facilities employ another 11,500 hardworking men and women. These are high-paying, high-skilled jobs. The iron mining industry workers earn between $85,000 and $100,000 a year and are active members of their communities. Environmental stewardship is a core value of Minnesota's iron mines, and the iron mines have made significant changes to their processes and facilities to honor their agreement with the state and communities where they operate. American iron mining and steelmaking companies are regularly awarded for environmental stewardship awards for their work to become a more responsible industry. Minnesota's iron mines provide 85% of the nation's iron, which is used to make the steel that makes the things that we use every day. For example, building a wind turbine requires between 200 and 400 tons of steel. As a strategic partner, the iron mines would like to continue to provide the nation with the iron it needs to make the steel for the green revolution of the future. The Iron Mining Association firmly believes that these American iron mines operate safer and more responsibly than anywhere else in the world. This could not be made more clear than when looking at a map of greenhouse gas emissions by country. You can do that by visiting www.minnesota.gov www.waqi.info, a World Air Quality Index map. Iron mines are the single largest consumer of energy in Minnesota. The iron mining facilities run 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Over the last 10 years, the iron mines in northeast Minnesota have seen a 60% increase in their energy rates. These increases are not sustainable. Each iron mine is competing globally for the same customer base. The iron mines are greatly affected by global pricing fluctuations and changes, as was seen in 2015 when 7 facilities idled due to illegal steel dumping. That same year, the state legislature acknowledged the difficult circumstances faced by the iron mining industry and other affected industries and passed energy-intensive, trade-exposed legislation to help alleviate some of the massive increases. In September 2017, the Public Utilities Commission further recognized and supported energy-intensive, trade-exposed reductions to large power users. The adoption of 25 by 25 renewable energy standard was one of the factors that has driven this considerable cost increase to the iron mines. As new regulations or increased renewable energy standards are adopted, the iron mines become less cost competitive and thereby less likely to be able to keep their facilities open. Any curtailment or idling of these facilities comes at a tremendous cost to our environment as other countries ramp up their less responsible iron mining. As Minnesota embarks on a green energy revolution, 2 things must be acknowledged. First, that revolution can't happen without the raw materials like iron ore to build the infrastructure. The second is a green energy revolution can't be truly green if it is built with raw materials mined in nations without environmental regulations. In order to ensure this green revolution is built with responsibly sourced infrastructure, we'd recommend a cap on the increases to energy-intensive, trade-exposed industries like ours, as was done in Illinois for their 2017 Future Energy Jobs Act. Germany took a similar approach in protecting important industries in its approach to carbon reduction and renewable energy promotion. Minnesota can and should do the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Corrado, and next up, Delaney Russell.
My name is Kevin Corrado. This love letter that I'm going to read to you will make more sense if you realize that my 2-year-old granddaughter currently calls me Baba. It's dated February 14th, 2030. Dear Baba, it feels strange writing a Valentine's letter to you. When you died in 2028, just past your 78th birthday, I thought I would never be able to communicate with you ever again. Somehow, writing a letter seems like a special way to connect my thoughts to your spiritual energy. I want to send you my gratitude and love for trying to make this a better world for me, my cousins, and for future generations. Also, I want to especially thank those women and men who were in the Minnesota legislature in 2019. You told me that many legislators truly cared about present and future residents of the whole state. If I remember correctly, you said that a bill was passed later in that year to establish state standards for all utilities to use renewable and non-carbon sources for the generation of electricity by the year 2040, or maybe it was 2050. I think you called it the 100% clean energy bill. Sadly, now in 2030, recent global and local reports are saying we need to accelerate the transition to 100% clean energy sources. Oh, I just want to let you know that Mom, Dad, and I went to a rally at the Capitol last Saturday to support more funding for the Minnesota Climate Refugee Fund. I don't think you had that in 2019. We're one of the families in our neighborhood sponsoring a climate refugee family from Florida. Baba, I miss you. I wish you were here to tell me more stories about how the 2019 100% Clean Energy Bill was a turning point for my future and for all of Minnesota and beyond. I can assure you that many other states have been inspired by the compassion and courage of Minnesota climate activists and bold political leaders. Happy Valentine's Day, wherever your spirit may be, with tons of carbon-free love, Sydney.
Delaney Russell, and then Kent Solom.
I just want to cry listening to that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Long.
and members of the Energy Committee for this opportunity to speak. My name is Delaney Russell, and I have 3 points. First, I want to start by thanking Representative Long, Senator Friends, and the 32 co-authors of the Pathway to 100% legislation. It takes a lot of work to do this, skillful, behind the scenes, and unrecognized. I want to publicly show my appreciation. Second, democracy depends in part on showing up, and I want to stand with those promoting a stable climate and sustainable economy with related living wage jobs. Individual actions on this can go only so far. Only our government can strategically align the activities of the community as a whole so that 100% renewable energy is consumed by all, not just by those of us with the resources to research and buy into this or that solar garden. Yes, there are valid concerns, and we've heard some today, but I'd offer that they are less than the concerns of the alternatives and that we can address them. Finally, I'm here because our government's fundamental role is to promote the general welfare, regardless of who shows up. As a legal aid attorney, I want to point out that not everyone has the capacity to show up at hearings like this. So many people would lose their jobs if they took time off of work, or they might lack daycare or transportation. My experience is that people living in poverty want the best for our children, for their children, as much as any of us in this room. I appreciate that this proposal considers the needs of all in our community and aligns the electric consumption of all in our community. Thank you again for going the extra mile, for overcoming momentum, and for promoting general welfare. Thank you.
Thank you. Kent Solem and then Rob Scott Hoagland.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ken Sulem. I'm with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, and we're here today not to oppose the bill, not to argue facts here and there, but to say if we're going to be leaders, we need to make sure we're leaders in the right direction, doing things the right way. Passing a mandate can be an easy thing for a legislature to do. Making it happen, actually being able to achieve that goal, is another matter. And frankly, right now, I don't think we have all the answers we need from the utility side to answer your questions. We need to have more information as to what exactly will it take to get to this goal, what transmission lines are needed, what costs are going to be incurred, what are the secondary impacts. I think it was Representative Mahoney this morning said that this issue isn't in a vacuum. There's cross issues that happen, as was mentioned in the questions earlier. We are seeing thousands and thousands of acres of tillable land coming off the production line, not so much as a balancing of crops, but simply because it's a price that is far better than any crop you'll have right now. And we see that a lot when I worked with the townships for almost 18 years. We were constantly dealing with those farming practices that were changing and the impacts that we had on that community. So what we would propose and what our association stance has been is that we have a study that would be a comprehensive review of all the steps that are required to get to this objective, realizing that this is a goal that's a laudable goal, but in the bill it's a mandate that falls on us without a clear platform of how we're supposed to get there, how we're supposed to pay for it, what the secondary impacts might be. And so that's simply our request, that we have the proper study done by a neutral group, perhaps MISO, perhaps the NERC, an entity that understands all the regulations we have to play by at both the state and federal levels, and those types of things, so we can do this the right way. Because if we can't afford to not do anything, we can't afford to do it wrong. Thank you.
Bob Scott Hoagland and then Stuart Henry.
Good afternoon, or maybe good evening. It's kind of drifting into that. Representative Wagenius and members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify on House File 700 today. I represent Missouri River Energy Services. We're a municipal power agency that provides wholesale electricity and other services to 61 municipal electrics in 4 states. 25 of our members are located here in Minnesota, basically on the western edge of Minnesota. Missouri River and its members are all not-for-profit We're customer-owned, and we're customer-controlled. And to date, we are on track to meet the renewable energy standard with a variety of resources, including wind, solar, and hydroelectric. Missouri River Energy Services is not opposed to adding more renewable energy. We are opposed to the steepness of the curve, in increasing that standard. With such a steep rise in a relatively short period of time, it may not be possible to get all of the generation and transmission in place to meet that new goal. As an example, Missouri River Energy Services is in the process of constructing a small hydroelectric facility in a small flood control dam down by Des Moines, Iowa. This resource will generate about 36.4 megawatts of electricity, or enough electricity to serve the needs of about 18,000 homes. Despite the strong support from the local community and from the state, the permitting process alone took us 10 years. And beginning to end, the project will have taken about 16 years. And we expect that, barring any really delays, we expect that facility to be commercially available for us in 2020. That project will provide our members with basically a baseload renewable energy resource. That means when the sun is not shining, the wind is not blowing, it'll still be capable of producing electricity because the river will still be flowing. Renewable energy will always be a part of our portfolio and resource mix. But to promote reliability, we need a diverse portfolio of energy resources to keep the lights on and to keep the furnaces running. Our Red Rock Hydroelectric Project is a reminder that we need time to rebuild robust generation and transmission and to keep reliability as our primary focus. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I look forward to working with you again.
Stuart Henry and then John Brecky.
Hi, thank you for letting me testify today. My name is Stuart Henry, and I'm speaking today as a homeowner in support of this bill. Based on my experience working to electrify everything in our home, I believe a 100% renewable electricity system will create numerous jobs in traditional building trades. My wife and I pay for wind source renewable energy from Xcel. We have made three major purchases in our journey to electrify everything. We bought a used Nissan Leaf for $13,000 after trade-in. We replaced our gas clothes dryer for an electric one and our gas water heater for an electric heat pump water heater. Because of the bigger load on our electrical system, we're advised to increase our home's current from 100 amps to 200 amps. We also needed to install several 220-volt plugs. Finally, we decided to separate our garage electricity from our home's electricity so that we could take advantage of cheaper electricity rates for nighttime car charging. We spent $6,000 on an electrician, some more money to Xcel, and around $3,800 to an HVAC installer for the heat pump water heater. Now, we are just one household. But even if a small percentage of households in Minnesota choose, are incentivized, or mandated to electrify everything, there will be millions spent on traditional building trades such as electricians and HVAC installers. A move to 100% renewable energy is good for our health, our future, and our economy. Thank you.
Thank you. John Brecky and then Christopher Schoenherr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Brecky. I'm with Great River Energy. We are a generation and transmission cooperative serving 28 distribution retail cooperatives spread throughout the state of Minnesota. We are supportive of the state's carbon and energy goals, and we are opposed to this legislation in its present form. Utilities are taking voluntary action. In our case, we are down 38% on carbon emissions since 2005. That's a reduction trajectory that's not required by law. Additionally, in 2018, we voluntarily set a 50% renewable energy by 2030 goal. And we went ahead and met the state's mandate for 25% renewable energy 8 years before it was required. That's happening without a law. It's our member consumers taking action through their elected boards. Indeed, we are the one sector of the economy that's tracking with the state carbon reduction goals. We are aware of the state's 80% carbon reduction goal by 2050, and we realize what's expected of us. We take it seriously, and we have a built-in incentive to meet it because of electrification opportunities that have been mentioned. This legislation is unnecessary, and it risks making the transition more expensive for consumers because it changes the market power dynamic of renewable energy projects. Developers can charge us more when they know we are bound by law, and those costs get passed on to Minnesota consumers. Finally, and very importantly, the requirement of 100% by 2050 versus 80% under current law, that choice needs to be revisited for two reasons. One, the cheapest reductions are the first reductions under the law of diminishing marginal returns. And the last 20% are the most expensive. A cost-benefit study of the specific difference between an 80% reduction and a 100% reduction should be undertaken. Secondly, we are part of a market, and we have power plants from other states that affect our market, that are sold into our market, and we cannot control the flow of power between state lines. Some of those plants will benefit from this law affecting Minnesota peaking plants and forcing a shutdown locally so that plants in other states can run and emit the CO2. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher Schoenherr, and after that, Rick Evans.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you this evening. I'm Chris Schoenherr from Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. We are the wholesale energy provider to 18 municipal utilities scattered across Minnesota. Our member communities and the people who live there are much like all Minnesotans. They care about the environment. They care about and are supportive of renewable energy. But at the same time, they expect us to balance that with providing continued reliability and affordability of that energy. That's our job, and we take that responsibility very seriously. A balanced generation portfolio is very important. We learn that repeatedly on the warmest and the coldest days of the year. We talked about the polar vortex this morning. I'd like to talk instead about when we hit our peak demand this past July, and everything worked the way it was supposed to. Our wind generation performed very well, and as is typically the case, as you get towards the middle part of the morning, it starts to taper off. But as the sun comes up, our solar generation started to come on. But in between there, the clouds come across, and they'll bring the solar generation down from time to time. But when that happens, we have natural gas engines that can ramp up really quickly and ramp back down very quickly that fill in those gaps. With that, that's the way it was designed to work. It's kind of nice when that actually happens and things work out well. Right now, we don't currently have a commercially available carbon-free generation technology that could play that fill-in-the-gap role as effectively. So until such time that technology is commercially available, the 100% carbon-free does give us pause. I think we're all hopeful and optimistic that technology will be developed, but I can't look you in the eye today and say that that's in place now. On the renewable energy standard, we believe the policymakers should have all the necessary information related to the cost and the timing of the transmission system upgrades before setting a revised standard. Conducting the appropriate studies is not meant to be a barrier to achieving public policy goals, but a necessary step to inform the process on the best, most cost-effective way to reach those goals. We talked this morning that interconnecting more of the grids across the country could help deal with the intermittent issue of renewables, and I think that's true. But we also know that building transmission can be disruptive and expensive, so we want to do that right. Wind energy in particular is an attractive resource at this particular point in time. We're concerned that a mandate may serve to make it more expensive to do what economics are already driving us to do. In closing, we're committed to being a partner in meeting the state's energy policy objectives and look forward to working with all stakeholders to quickly, reliably, and cost-effectively meet those public policy goals. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick Evans, and then Joe Pereira.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Evans. I'm with Xcel Energy.
As many people here know and has been referred to earlier in the testimony, a couple of months ago, our CEO issued a directive to the company. The directive was that we would shoot for 80% reduction in our carbon emissions from our 2005 levels to be accomplished by 2030, and that we would have an aspirational goal of reaching 100% carbon-free by 2050. That was a press release and it was in the newspaper, but to our company, it's quite a bit more than that. This is a directive from the boss of 12,000 employees working in 8 states across the United States that this is a goal that is expected to be achieved. And it is now the directive of all of the employees of Xcel Energy to help achieve this. As I think you can understand from some of the testimony today and Mr. O'Connell's study that he talked about this morning, this is not an easy thing to do. It is not an uncomplicated thing to do. In fact, it's a very complicated thing to do. Fortunately, here in Minnesota, we have a perfect tool for accomplishing something complicated like this. It's called the Integrated Resource Plan. It's a study, much like Mr. O'Connell's, except it's done by the utility specifically for the design of the infrastructure that we have, and it's updated every 2 years. It is an extensive process that incorporates science, engineering, very sophisticated computer modeling. It also involves projecting costs, projecting load, how much our customers are going to demand, projecting changes in technology, projecting what public policy will be coming into the future. In July of this year, we will file our latest resource plan. That will just be the beginning of the process. Then we'll go through a 12 to 18 month process where the experts of the Public Utilities Commission, the Office of the Attorney General, the Department of Commerce, and all of the other people who, the stakeholders, environmental groups and what have you, will be able to engage in a very public process that will examine in a great deal of detail this process that's been laid out in our resource plan. That's the process that will determine the most effective way to implement the goal that our CEO has set for us. And it is very unlikely that it's going to match the specific numbers that are somewhat arbitrarily assigned to specific years for renewable energy, which is only one of the tools that will help us reach that goal. In addition, it's important to understand that sometimes the renewable energy standard could actually work against the carbon standard, or rather reaching the carbon goals. For example, under this bill, we would have to select a biomass project which emits carbon dioxide and which, by the way, is very expensive in lieu of a large hydro project which emits no carbon dioxide and is relatively inexpensive. We would have to select building natural gas plants perhaps instead of extending the life of our nuclear plants or even continuing the life of our nuclear plants. I see the amount of time, so let me just say, we understand the goal, we share the goal. Let the experts choose the tools.
Thank you. Joe Pereira. And then Steve Berchoka.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Pereira. I'm Regulatory Director at the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota. CUB is an independent consumer energy advocate representing residential customers and small business at the legislature, the Public Utilities Commission, and other policymaking arenas. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill HF 700. In addition to the work that CUB does with policymakers across the state, CUB regularly meets with local communities and civic organizations to provide relevant and digestible information to help them understand their energy systems and the energy transition Minnesota is undergoing. Most importantly, CUB's outreach teams sit down with Minnesota families week in and week out to review their energy bills, assist them in understanding their energy use, and help them find ways to control how they pay for energy. In our work with Minnesota households, we hear a lot about people's perspectives on energy. Most of these comments revolve around challenges paying bills, how to read their utility bill, how to make their house less drafty,
and what does the future hold for energy in our state? Overwhelmingly, we hear from customers across the state that they want cleaner, more carbon-free energy. The pathway to 100% legislation is a bold step toward addressing these concerns, the concerns of these households. It's a big step in protecting Minnesota for our clients. For many years, Minnesota was known nationwide as a leader in clean energy. The pathway legislation is a chance for our state to again reaffirm this leadership. At CUB, our work centers around saving customers money and advocating for customer-centered policy. This legislation does that. The bill sets up achievable goals without creating unnecessary burdens on consumers. The bill is appropriately flexible, allowing for off-ramps should customers or reliability be negatively affected. The bill protects workers, strengthens communities, and creates an energy economy that includes everyone. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee and the sponsors of this bill for providing leadership, creating achievable goals, and moving forward an energy vision in the interest of consumers. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Virchota, and then followed by Bree Halverson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee. I'm here to represent the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association. It's a group of 8 waste energy facilities that are currently operating in Minnesota. I'm here to address specifically the part of the bill there's a change in the definition of biomass under the new legislation. In general, the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association supports the general language and supports a more carbon-free generation in the future. Our concern is that the wording of this bill specifically excludes waste-to-energy from being allowed under the eligible energy technologies while allowing landfill gas generation. This bill is picking winners and losers in technology, and by choosing what technology is allowed to fill these new requirements, they're causing some issues. This bill would cause issues directly with our industry. On the federal level, waste energy is included in the definition of renewable energy, along with Minnesota and 30 other states included in their definition. As a main part of this legislation, it's trying to move towards carbon-free generation by 2050. The U.S. EPA defines that from MSW, every ton of MSW that's burned in a waste energy plant actually reduces overall greenhouse gas emissions by every 1 ton for every ton of MSW burned. Between now and 2050, waste energy can be an important part as an energy partner to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while providing reliable baseload renewable energy. By definition, renewable energy is defined as something that's locally sourced and sustainable. If you think about garbage, it's local, and under the most optimistic conditions of advanced recycling and material reuse, society will continue to generate some waste. It's important to look at this waste as a resource instead of something that should be piled up into a landfill. Energy sales are used to offset the tipping fees and allow waste energy plants to be competitive with landfills. This is critical in keeping the cost of treating MSW at a reasonable level. And case 3M in my area from Alexandria was allowed to expand their operations specifically because they were powered by renewable energy from our facility. If that wasn't allowed, that plant would have left Minnesota and probably United States for production. In closing, I just want to say we are in general support of the bill and think that it's critical that waste energy is considered a partner as we head to a more greener and carbon-reduced generation. Thank you.
Thank you. Bree Halverson and then Don Arnosti.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius. And committee for the opportunity to speak. My name is Bree Halverson, and I'm the regional program manager for the Blue Green Alliance. Blue Green Alliance is a national partnership headquartered here in Minnesota that brings together America's largest labor unions and most influential environmental organizations to turn today's environmental challenges, including climate change, into job-creating economic opportunities. At the heart of this partnership is a firm conviction that Americans do not have to choose between good jobs and a clean environment or a safe climate. We believe that we can and must have both. The world's leading scientific organizations have been unambiguous that climate change is a dire and urgent threat, and that the longer we delay, the stronger the action required. Simultaneously, we believe that there is a significant opportunity to create good-paying jobs in this state while adopting smart solutions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and avoid the worst impacts of climate change. BGA supports the expansion of clean energy and believes any policies that expand clean energy must also include provisions to ensure that jobs created are good-paying local jobs. We want to thank Representative Long for putting forth a bill that includes language highlighting the needs of workers currently employed in the fossil fuel energy plants, as well as workers who will be employed in the clean energy economy going forward. It is vital to put in place policies and incentives to ensure the quality of jobs created as a result of an increase in carbon-free energy. In addition, it is equally vital that workers and communities impacted by the shutdown of fossil fuel plants are not left behind. We look forward to working with the committee and Representative Long to strengthen provisions in this bill that speak to these critical stakeholders. We appreciate that Chair Wagenius and leaders in the Minnesota House of Representatives take seriously the climate crisis we face. We also want to extend our appreciation to leaders like Representative Long, whom are pushing for solutions that will both reduce emissions and create investment, opportunity, quality jobs, and communities throughout our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Donna Nosty and then Dave McNary.
Hello, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Don Arnosti. I'm the executive director of the Isaac Walton League. We had hoped to have our legislative intern, Sydney Anderson, testify, but she's a student at the university and had to go to her lab course this evening. I'll try to speak for her. The Isaac Walton League is a 97-year young organization, and our younger members particularly are very concerned about their future on this planet and what's happening. House File 700 is a pathway bill to where we need to get. It's a modest bill. It's not proceeding as rapidly as we actually need to do to safeguard the future of the younger members of our society and some of those who are not yet born. We recognize this is an important direction and thank Representative Long for introducing the bill. We believe that it's appropriate to recognize that burning garbage is not a sustainable technology because we need to do other things to address climate change, including reducing what is considered waste in society, and for that matter, nor is landfill gas, as the previous testifier pointed out. Thank you for Section 5, Subdivision 9, which does recognize local benefits and try to support workers' rights and health and make sure that there's equity and access to people of all incomes for renewable energy. Many testifiers have said that we don't quite know how to get there, that some of these goals are ambitious and they're not quite sure exactly how to accomplish it. Well, I would remind all of us that when President Kennedy said we should reach the moon in less than a decade, nobody knew how to do that either. This is our generation's moonshot, and I would say it's more important than that generation's moonshot. It is more important that we get this right, and we're embarking on this effort. This bill allows appropriate off-ramps and opportunities for problems that we may get into as we move towards this goal, and I think it's something that we urge the committee and the legislature to pass. It's our belief that actually we're going to be revisiting this policy in a few years because we don't believe that the goals are aggressive enough to do what climate change demands of us. But it is a good start, and it's something that we must begin. And our regulated utilities, in exchange for their monopoly business, have accepted that regulation is part of their business plan. It's very appropriate for the legislature to set this kind of direction. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Dave McNary, and then Victoria Reinhardt.
Chair, members, Thank you for the opportunity to testify. David McNary, Assistant Director, Hennepin County Environment and Energy Department. In 2007, the Hennepin County Board adopted greenhouse gas reduction goals of 80% by 2050. The county believes that the broad goals of this bill are consistent with goals shared by the county. We understand a goal of this bill is to create carbon-free electricity to help reduce climate change. An unintended consequence may result in increased methane production, a greenhouse gas far more potent than carbon. Actions that result in landfilling more garbage and consequently releasing more methane to the atmosphere will exacerbate climate change from waste, not reduce it. Hennepin has committed significant public investment to manage waste and serve the Minneapolis downtown electric load and steam to district heating and cooling. Our facility business model includes owning renewable energy credits, which this bill eliminates. By law, counties oversee municipal solid waste management. Hennepin's strategy to recycle 75% of waste by 2030 reduces waste at the source, pushes recycling, establishes commercial organics composting, and minimizes landfilling as much as possible. Hennepin County takes seriously climate change mitigation and adaptation. When we installed a 96-kilowatt solar PV in 2009, it was the largest PV array in Minnesota. Consistent with that innovation, we now operate the largest gravel bed tree nursery in the state, growing resilient trees for public lands. 10% of electricity powering county libraries and service centers is now generated by community solar gardens, which equals 6.3 million kilowatt hours annually. By prioritizing conservation, we cut energy use by 3% year over year for the past 4 years. And we've now reduced greenhouse gas emissions from operations by 25%, exceeding the county board's Cool County pledge. Hennepin County supports legislative efforts to mitigate climate change and help local governments adopt meaningful adaptation strategies. We urge you to work with us to fully achieve that potential in the pursuit of sound solid waste management policy. We respectfully request you remove the strikeout from lines 1.20 to 1.22 of HF 700. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Victoria Reinhart. I am on the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I'm chair of the Partnership on Waste and Energy, which is a joint powers board with Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties. And Dave did a great job of going over some of the basics of what we are trying to do as counties. I just have to say that although I am here to speak in favor and support the goals of this legislation, I need to bring up a county concern that we have with the change to the definition of biomass, which eliminates energy recovery from waste. The state has mandated counties to be responsible for waste management, and we strongly support the waste management hierarchy, both in our actions and in what we our plans are for the future. We put waste reduction, reuse, and recycling ahead of processing and landfilling. We were among the first counties in the state to implement curbside recycling in all our communities, among the first to establish recycling sites for yard waste, and have created extensive programs for business recycling. The result is that the recycling rates in our counties are among the highest in the state. Second, resource recovery facilities are at the nexus of two important state policies: advancing renewable energy and managing waste in an environmentally responsible manner. They really can't be viewed solely through one lens. While generating electricity from significant volumes of waste, these facilities also are important in reducing greenhouse gases when they divert waste from landfills. Finally, at the local level, the proposed legislation could stop planned innovations in their tracks. Ramsey and Washington counties recently purchased the Ramsey-Washington County Recycling and Energy Center. The facility processes 450,000 tons of waste per year, recovers metals for recycling, and produces refuse-derived fuel that is used at Xcel Energy for electricity. That is old technology. Our plans in owning and operating this facility are to enhance the system to recover more value from trash, which means sorting recyclables beyond metals and sending RDF to a privately owned gasification technology to recover biofuels from RDF, which is carbon-free. Our plans include expanding recycling of organic waste to all households in the two counties and continuing to strongly pursue separation of organics by businesses through our biz recycling program. So I'm going to skip to the final end here, and that is by defining RDF as non-renewable, we believe that this legislation could halt our plans to move forward with developing the market for RDF biofuels. We are planning, we know that Xcel is going to be going carbon-free in electrical generation, which is why we are vigorously pursuing gasification from the RDF rather than burning it. You have to wonder, where is the waste going to go if it doesn't, we don't want it to go into landfills. And so what we really want to do is to deal with it and value the recyclable materials and so that they are not lost as well. Finally, I look forward to addressing county concerns with the proponents of this bill, Representative Long and members of this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now we would have a representative of Laborers International Union of North America and then Max J. Dixon. Max J. Dixon. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak. And thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Long, and all the sponsors of this bill for your leadership on this issue. My name is Max J. Dixon. I'm a Twin Cities native living in South Minneapolis. I'm here as a volunteer leader with the CR Club today. There are a number of us that you've heard from today, and I'm also glad to be able to represent the voices of the many others who aren't in the room here but are nonetheless enthusiastically supporting this bill. I grew up here in Minnesota, but I've spent much of my career on the Gulf Coast in Louisiana and Florida. And while living there, I watched extreme weather events ravage the communities that I was in. I worked my way through school at a small Creole restaurant in the French Quarter of New Orleans, run by this sweet little old Creole family, the Oliviers, who had run their business for 40 years. And after watching the damage caused by storms and by the BP oil disaster, they had to close their business after 40 long years. I know that you have heard from numerous experts since the beginning of the session who have warned you that the impacts of climate change are coming here to Minnesota and have warned you about the ways that those will be felt in our community and by our farmers and businesses in the years to come. I'm supporting this bill because I believe that it recognizes the stark reality of the situation that we face and proposes a bold action to move us into the clean energy future that we need. I am particularly glad to see that the bill includes language to ensure that these benefits of the energy transition are shared equitably and by all Minnesotans, especially historically marginalized communities. I personally moved home to Minnesota because with my fiance, we hope to someday raise our kids in the same beautiful state that I grew up in. I believe this bill is a strong step towards making sure that that future remains a possibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Alan Mueller. Lauren Schulthorst. Horst. Oh, is Alan Mueller?
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I serve as the Energy Policy Director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber represents 2,300 employers of every size and over 500,000 employees in every industry across the state. It is important to point out that our members in each and every sector are diligently working and innovating to make their products, processes, systems, and infrastructure cleaner and more efficient, including the energy-intensive sectors that power our state's economy. As you contemplate these changes, I appreciate the opportunity to share the Chamber's energy policy priority: maintaining reliable, cost-effective power at competitive prices for Minnesota businesses. In a competitive global economy, cost considerations across all business inputs impacts Minnesota companies' ability to succeed or grow, including energy affordability and reliability. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, Minnesota's electric rates over the past 20 years have increased faster than the U.S. average in inflation, and today we rank 20 highest for commercial and 15th highest for industrial rates in the nation. To power our state, our members support strategies that consider all of the energy resources, efficiencies, and emerging opportunities available, as long as those strategies result in cost-effective power, competitive rates, ensure energy system reliability, and do not shift costs to others. Given current market dynamics and increasingly competitive costs for renewable energy, the state can achieve its renewable energy policy goals without imposing additional mandates. And more companies are voluntarily reducing their environmental impacts in response to consumer preferences. Finally, we encourage all stakeholders to note that higher power rates in Minnesota force some of our companies to shift production to places with lower costs but higher environmental impacts. In closing, Minnesota's energy policy must benefit every sector of Minnesota's economy. We believe that we can enable businesses to obtain competitively priced, reliable power while minimizing environmental impacts and advancing innovation in Minnesota's energy industries. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to share this perspective with your committee today.
Thank you so much. Rose Thielen.
Hello, my name is Rose Thielen, and I have with me Liam McCormick, because as I think about this issue, I don't really know what's going to get through to people, particularly those who are not inclined to do something about the crisis that's in front of us. I went up to Duluth last weekend, and I was like, oh my God, there's winter. You know, this is what it used to be like in central Minnesota, and I envisioned a day when we'd all be going up to Duluth maybe for the weekend or for a week during the winter, just to experience what winter used to be like. And so what will it take to have people do what they can? If we have the will, we'll find the skill, right? It's 2045, but then we'll be able to get there. But like I say, you look at me and you probably go, oh, we know what she's going to say, and we're going to have all our arguments against her. So I wanted to give a chance to somebody who probably knows more than any of us in the room about why it's so important. So Liam, have at him.
Thank you. So I'm growing up in a world where I see all these things, like I see these species that might be extinct in 20 years, and I see these forests that are being depleted. And I think, I don't want to lose these things. It's not you that's going to be affected by this. It's not any of you. It's going to be me and my generation. Like, no one here is going to be affected by this. So I want you to think about not how this could help our economy now or what could help the people now, but how do we plan for the future and not be penny-wise, pound-foolish. I want to see the endangered species come back, and I want to live in a world where I can walk in the forest and not just live in an everlasting desert and have the ice caps just be a distant memory. I want to live in a world without climate change. So please do something.
Thank you for your testimony. Maura Walsh, and then Amelia Gonzalez-Alvos.
Hi, thanks for this chance to speak. My name is Moira Walsh. I'm from St. Cloud. I never paid much attention to environmental issues. It just really wasn't my thing. I don't like the outside. I figured the tree huggers had it covered, and I was more concerned about global poverty. So I trained for that, and I was very lucky to get a chance to work as a humanitarian aid worker in Asia and Africa for 5 years. But over time, it became clear to me that it's the global poor that are going to bear the brunt of climate change, and that's climate change that we created by cranking carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, you know, as an expression of our wealth. And the injustice of that really embarrasses me. And add to it that climate change is driving an increase in refugees globally at the same time that the wealthiest countries are shying from their responsibilities to accept refugees. And I find that just something that I know that we can do better, something that we can address here in Minnesota. The state is a leader, and I hope that we decide to step forward and lead the lesser states with our newer, higher goal, and bringing our experts along with us all the way. Thanks.
Thank you. Amelia Gonzalez-Alvarez, and then Sean Chigalski. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emilia Gonzalez-Avalos. I am the executive director of an organization called Unidos Minnesota, and we're an organization that centers community organizing in the Latino community. And our constituency basically lives within Minneapolis and Poland, the metro area, and also in concentrated parts in southern Minnesota. So to be specific, Worthington, St. James, St. Peter, Mankato, Austin, Rochester. And I'm here to share two aspects of this work and why we're supporting this bill. One is the professional aspect. As you may know, the Latinx community is relatively young. Most of the population is under 35 years old and a little bit over 20 years old. That's the big bulk of the Latino community. Most of them are voters. And when we have surveyed our folks across the state during our public assemblies, environmental issues and climate change are one of the top three issues that the Latinx community thinks about when they're civically engaged. So this is a very important issue for our community across the board. So on the other hand, on the personal side of my testimony, I am an immigrant. I was born in Mexico City. And through history, we've known that immigration has been fueled by either wanting to get an opportunity, escaping poverty, escaping civil unrest. But lately, climate change is one of the reasons why people are being pushed out of their countries of origin and their native lands. The other thing is that as an immigrant myself, I came to this country when I was a child, and the same is with my husband. He came to this country after becoming an orphan when he was 10 years old. And not only he has called Minnesota home for many years, he's almost 40, but he also went back to school to finish his degree on green and renewable energy from Century College. So this is an issue that he cares deeply about. And he decided to make this change of career because he developed severe asthma and severe allergies to the point where his lungs were very close of collapsing, and he had to request many days off work. That, you know, as I hear conversation about the cost of utilities, perhaps we also should talk about the cost of medical bills because of these conditions that are causing generational changes in our livelihoods. This is a sickness that we've never had in our family history. So, and then this, my testimony was, it was changed last minute because actually my daughter, who's 9, was supposed to be here and testify with me, but she's on the other side of the river because of the snowstorm. So if Madam Chair allows me, I would like to tape a very quick recording of her from Minneapolis right now. Will that be okay? Will that be okay? So my daughter was going to be here with me and share her testimony, but she couldn't because of the snow after school. So I wonder if I'm allowed to play a very short, less than a 30 seconds recording of her talking about this issue.
30 seconds.
Thank you.
My children to enjoy the state I call home. My name is Miranda, and I want my grandchildren and my children to enjoy the state I call home. Some of you may not be with us in 2050, but I think I will. This bill is very important for my future.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have two more testifiers, Sean Sergalski and then Mayor Fry.
Hello, Chair Wagenius and representatives, thanks so much for having me come in. I'm Sean Gusheski, the director of the Alliance for Sustainability. And over the last 3 years, we've been helping 40 cities to work on their energy goals for their new 20-year comprehensive plans, and they're excited to get them done. So by having more rapid progress toward renewable energy, cities will be able to meet their renewable energy goals. And we see have Mayor Fry right here. A lot of it's right in the comp plan with the Minneapolis comp plan. So a couple of the areas that we'd love to have you guys work on is ensuring as we move toward a green grid that we also have distributed generation. I know a lot of cities have a lot of businesses that could benefit from solar. With all these federal tax credits, they can get solar on their buildings at a very low cost. Also by, you know, working on smart grid investments so we can take advantage of turning off demand. One of the exciting things is cities are also working on electrifying their transportation. For example, Minneapolis is working on electric vehicle hubs, and Rosemont actually worked with a developer to have 100 home subdivision that has the correct wiring in their garages to have electric vehicles. So this will help generate more electricity sales at night with wind power, which will help create lower rates for the overall rate base. One of the things we'd like to have you also work on is companion bills related to job training and research so that all parts of the state can benefit from very high energy efficient building construction, new type of building materials with panelized construction, looking at energy storage, and like DigiKey is building components for the smart grid. So we want to work with all the regional development agencies to have their community colleges have, you know, job training that would relate to that. And then I know that a lot of cities would be concerned about anything that would cause any of the resource recovery facility to shut down. We do have the Elk River plant just shut down, and it's going to cause a problem for maybe more landfilling. So try to do what you can to keep, we're going to reduce waste as fast as we can, but also figure out how to keep the resource facilities going when they need to. And then my daughter couldn't make it here because she has lifeguard training at the Y, but she saw that picture in the Star Trib with the entire page of brown where we couldn't have forests in the state. So she wanted me to talk about her concern. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mayor Fry? You are our last testifier, so you may put on the exclamation point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I do appreciate you hearing my testimony for today, and I'm also appreciative that I was able to go last, because otherwise I wouldn't have made it on time. It took something like 90 minutes to get from Minneapolis City Hall to this location, and I think that's underestimating. So now is the time. Now is the time for us to move forward with 100% clean and equitable energy that benefits Minnesotans, starting with 100% clean and renewable electricity. Minnesota has made strong progress on moving away from coal and investing in wind, solar, and energy savings. And in fact, Minnesota has been at the forefront of many of these significant initiatives throughout history, so I see this one as no different. We do have the potential to move dramatically towards renewable mechanisms that will benefit our environment, and I think that we should be setting goals in doing so. By setting those clear and tangible and reachable goals by 2050, which is still some time away, we set the target that we can either meet and even exceed. But at the very least, setting the goal, I think, lays the foundation for the legislation that I think needs to move forward and encourages the private sector to follow suit. Minneapolis took a significant step just this last year by setting a community-wide standard of 100% renewable electricity by 2030, but emissions are not contained to a set geography. These emissions obviously are going to the entire state. And so I also believe in building on some of the economic benefit that we've seen. Right now, nearly 60,000 Minnesotans are now employed in the clean energy and efficiency sector. That number is just going dramatically up right now. If you combine clean energy jobs with tech jobs, those are far and away the fastest growing sectors that we have right now, and they're sectors that we should be investing in and sectors that we should be getting behind. Moving to 100% clean energy can and should benefit everyone. Every year we send billions of dollars out of state to pay for our energy, for coal, for oil, and for gas, and we should be investing those dollars to create a pathway for new jobs, sustainable careers, and a high quality of life. And so this policy, and I do appreciate Representative Long's work on it, would expand the growing energy jobs in Minnesota while advancing vocational training, job and economic opportunities for low-income communities and communities of color. During this transition, we need to find ways to strengthen all communities that are impacted by the transition away from fossil fuels. And we do need bold action on climate change. And I like to think that the city of Minneapolis is taking really aggressive measures to target it. Just before me, the speaker mentioned our 2040 comprehensive plan, which has renewable energy as a real focal point. And ensures that people can live within proximity of their jobs. It ensures that renewable and sustainable sources are valued over the traditional mechanisms. And we would love to partner with the state of Minnesota. I'll just finish by saying we need bold action. We need some serious bold action on climate change. It was actually a student that I was mentioning to the other day. I said, you know, the first person to die of climate change has already been born. And she corrected me and says, Mr. Mayor, I apologize. The first person to die of a climate change is already dead. They're right. We've got a lot of work to do, and I very much look forward to partnering with the state in doing so. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for your trip.
Thank you very much.
Representative Long, the final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you so much for this informational hearing. For the members, thank you for staying for the second round of testimony. We had 48 Minnesotans come to talk on this really important issue, and I think heard a lot of great perspectives and asked a lot of great questions. So looking forward to working with this committee on this important issue, and really grateful for the time and for, I think, taking a really important first step in talking about what's possible on clean energy in Minnesota.
Thank you. With that, members, this is adjourned.